Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the March 4th, 2014 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. We're here tonight for a regular business. I would point out to everyone that we would like to have any electronic devices silenced, cell phones, etc. And if there were an emergency, the exits are the stairs on my right in the back corner and on my left in the front corner. In case of a fire, please don't use the elevator. Would you please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The clerk will call the roll.
Ms. Kiefer? Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Robison?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
I am here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer? Mr. Lane?
Here.
14 members present.
Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
At this time, I would like to call Legislator Will Burbank up, and he has a presentation for distinguished youth of Tompkins County. And Will, please. Everybody's welcome. Wow, nice man. Welcome. Wow, look at them all. How about a hand for all the turnout here?
So this is Gabe Shapiro, and he was the recipient of some, I think, 14 letters.
You got to use the microphone.
Thank you. 14 letters in support of his nomination for the Distinguished Youth Award. And Gabe is a student at the Lehman Alternative Community School, where I have the honor of being a substitute teacher. I've done so for many years. Now, I know some of you are familiar with the school, but you may not know that this is a relatively small school that's been going for a number of years that combines both middle and high school students, so 6th grade through 12th. And one of the interesting things about being at that school is seeing kids go through the different stages and evolution. And as a substitute teacher, maybe some of you remember what it's like to be a sub, you know, when a sub was there. Kids are not always at their best, and middle schoolers are not particularly always at their best. But what happens is, in the right environment, they mature and they change and they evolve. And Gabe is, I think, a particularly wonderful example of that. And I'm actually going to turn it over to a few people that wanted to say a few things about what Gabe has done. And I'm going to introduce, start maybe with Diane or Dave. Okay. So, Dave, this is Dave McGivern. And Dave's official title, I actually had to ask today, he is head custodian for the school. But that so totally does not really describe the role that he does in that school, which is just amazing on several levels. But Dave, take it.
Thank you. Well, you've just met Gabe. I've known Gabe for more than 7 years since his entry into the Lehman Alternative School. In that time, I've had the pleasure of working very closely with Gabe in a variety of capacities as both the building manager, custodian, and the community outreach worker. I've watched Gabe grow from an awkward middle school student into a self-confident, articulate, and responsible young adult. Gabe has demonstrated growth and maturity that far exceed his years, and the tone of decency and perseverance he has set for others to follow is exemplary. As a middle school student, Gabe was not unlike most others in that he struggled to find his identity. His focus on academics was less than his focus on social interactions, and he developed lasting friendships through his compassionate and thoughtful actions. As Gabe entered high school, confident in his ability to make and keep quality friendships, he made a concerted and serious shift to improve his performance as a student. It was at this time that he truly began to discover himself. Gabe set the achievement bar high and worked tirelessly to reach or exceed his personal expectations. In a very short time, Gabe realized that he had the power to express himself that others did not possess, and he used that power to champion causes that would benefit all. He was a key leader in our school-wide effort to mentor younger students through encouragement and acceptance, irrespective of any student's age or grade. He possesses a natural ability to make others feel at ease and comfortable, and even fostered friendships with students on the fringe. Gabe never felt or acted superior to others, and his actions allowed others to feel safe and confident in their own abilities. Gabe also has been among the most politically active students to grace our halls and has been hugely effective promoting environmental causes such as composting, recycling, energy conservation, and waste reduction of our limited resources. Gabe has not limited his activism to inside our school halls, but is equally committed to a larger Ithaca community. He is involved with the Mayor's Youth Council. He has helped organize a youth-driven effort called Power Shift to bring other teens into political action. He's active on the area-wide Public Transportation Committee Advisory Committee. He's our student representative to the Sustainability Center and an active member of the Energy Action Plan Advisory Committee. Gabe does all this while managing to be a productive and successful learner. You would be very hard-pressed to find another young man as reliable, responsible, and dedicated to success as Gabe Shapiro. I feel that he'll be a tremendous asset to any organization he chooses to associate with, be it a university or a corporation. And he is driven not by accolades or monetary remuneration, but by his inner desire to be and do his very best. And it is no overstatement to say that Gabe is destined to do great good and represent his generation in the most stellar of terms. Thank you, Dave.
This is Dan Flerage, who's a science teacher at this school.
Just building off of what Will and Dave McGivern said very, very briefly, you guys have a lot to do tonight, I know. Good education is about empowerment, and it's really cool to be in a place where kids show up as children and leave as essentially adults. And done correctly, they leave powerfully. And what's beautiful, and Gabe is an example of this, is what it's like to put a lot of thoughtful effort into helping next steps and gradually realize that what your role should be at this moment is to get the heck out of the way.
Thank you, Dan. Okay. So, we have a... Diane Carruthers, the principal of Belayment Alternative School. I'm sorry.
Thank you. No, I really don't have a lot more to add either, except, Gabe, it's been a privilege to be your teacher and now your principal, and I feel like I've learned so much from you, and we're all so proud, looking forward to seeing where you go when you go out in the world, and hope you're taking a lot of us with you. Thanks.
Okay. So Gabe, we have here is the Distinguished Youth Award, and an award that emphasizes a truly inspirational and exceptional individual, Gabe Shapiro. And this is brought to you by our sponsors, Bangs Ambulance, the Pompas County Legislature, the Specialty Trophy and Awards of Dryden, Curry the Ice Cream, you'll discover why, and the Cuga Radio Group. So that's the sponsors.
You're welcome. Yeah, I did actually have a few things that I wanted to say. I definitely am going to keep it quick. And I'm also really bad with being so recognized because I start to cry. So sorry if that happens. What Will and Dave said about my transformation at ACS is really true. And without trying to be cheesy, I definitely think that I'm somebody who kind of escaped from a really crappy life. And from a life kind of where I was destined to failure, and found some sort of a spark in my heart and just turned myself around. And that transformation I have to thank LACS for, and my family, and the Ithaca community. For me, the community service stuff that I've been doing in Ithaca was never really like that intentional in the way that it kind of found me more than I found it. I just got thrown into all these different really cool things, like Get Your Green Back Tompkins led me to the Energy Action Plan Advisory Committee with Nick Goldsmith, and that led me to the Citizens Advisory Committee at TCAT, and then the Tompkins County Youth Services Department, and all of these things just kind of added up to become like my, just like this fabric of interesting and really cool stuff that I've been doing in the community. And finding that flow and also trying to pull all of those loose strings together has been really interesting and kind of what the past year has been for me. And throughout a lot of it, there's been a lot of moments of despair and hopelessness, but I think that most of all, I remember the moments when I was planning the Youth Power Summit and staying up till 3 in the morning because we were just so psyched about the fact that we were changing the world. And when I look back on my work in the community, those are the moments that stand out the most, the ones where we were really like onto something, and it felt like we were really strengthening this network of young people and really becoming excited together about being here on planet Earth, even though it's such a dark future. We were starting to realize that we're really taking a hold of it. And it's really been a struggle for me to not let my heart get filled up. One of my greatest teachers, who's actually right there taking pictures of me right now, taught me the lesson that if you give away too much of your heart, you will not have any left for yourself. And that's something that I've been thinking about for the past 2 years as I'm working in the community and with different committees and stuff, and trying to figure out the balance of giving everything I have, but also being who I am and having solitude and kind of holding on to my own heart and my own morals. And so that's been really interesting for me. I just want to thank my family for never giving up on me, and for Dave and all my teachers at ACS. And for Greg Lynn and the Beast Weavers for being here for me and seeing me through everything. I cannot be more grateful. Thank you.
A few things, Gabe. We have a thing for the Gator Ray group and something for Purity Ice Cream. I don't know what this is, but I think you'll discover. And these are the letters that were submitted on your behalf. So
thank you so much.
Thanks again. And thanks to everybody.
Wow, that's a hard act for anybody to follow. I can't ever remember one of these awards where we had so many folks come in. I can't ever remember one of these awards where we had that many nomination letters. Will, I think you picked a terrific recipient, and that was a great experience. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mike, if I could just add, I really want to thank the heroic efforts of Kathy and Karen who, you know, it's been a little while since we've done this, and some of the pieces of doing this had fallen apart, but they pulled it back together wonderfully, so thank you.
We need to get this back into a regular mode. There are a lot of great young people out there that are deserving of this. If the people in the audience or on TV are listening, if you know someone who's done service for our community, a young person, please submit a letter or an email to us. We'll be glad to consider that. I'd like to move now to privilege of the floor for the public. This is the public's opportunity to speak to us on any topic for up to 3 minutes. Kathy Covert, our clerk, will keep time. Some people have submitted blue cards, and we will take them in order. If you haven't submitted one and you still want to speak when we're done, we'll give you an opportunity to do that. I'm going to take a second to read off the blue card what people are agreeing to do when they come to speak to us. Remember, they are our guests. It says, I agree to a 3-minute time limit. I agree not to raise my voice. I agree not to use lewd, obscene, profane, or libelous language or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of peace. After 3 minutes, I agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. I agree that if I cause a disruption, and I'm asked to leave, I will leave the chambers. And I would add that we're asking folks to please refrain from any personal attacks on county employees. I would like to move to privilege the floor here. And the first blue card I have is Yvonne Davidson Roberts.
Dawson.
Dawson. I'm sorry. Can't even read this today. Sorry, Yvonne.
I'm from Groton. I'm here tonight because I have three grandchildren that are in foster care. And I am having problems with the Department of Social Services. And I am the grandmother. I'm trying to get custody of them, visitation of them. I'm not being allowed to have any contact with them at all by the Department of Social Services. Actually, the commissioner had me arrested for trespassing. When I tried to take a foster care class, the DA has dismissed those charges without me even going to court. I gave the board a file a while ago with a letter dated January 31st. It was written by Todd Husick from the Department of Social Services. In the last paragraph of that letter, it said visitation would need to be supervised, but due to your recent arrest, we are unable to provide you with access to our visitation rooms. Now that that trespass has been dismissed by the DA, because there was no grounds for that charge, I have requested visitation of my grandchildren, again, from the Department of Social Services. I received a phone call today from the legal department at Social Services from an attorney stating that I have to have an attorney call there to set up or to talk to them about visitation of my grandchildren. I want to know why I have to pay an attorney to talk to DSS employees about visitation of my grandchildren. DSS is not a court. Why do I have to have an attorney, a paid attorney, talk to them? Why can't I talk to them as a grandmother? Why can't I talk to the DSS employees? Why can't they talk to me? This is discrimination. They talk to other people. I mean, I do have an attorney in county court trying to get visitation and custody through county court, but I can't even get a court date until April 10th. And my grandkids have been there. I was getting visitation before until I told them I was going to file for custody, and they stopped all visitation. Now my attorney has to contact them. It's just, the whole thing is crazy. And it's costing a lot of money. It cost me like $1,000 because of this false arrest for trespassing. And I have to tell you, today I called New York State and I put in a complaint against the Commissioner of Social Services. And if I have to bring a civil suit, it's going to be with the federal government for violation of civil rights for discrimination, because that's what's going on here. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Oh, you have a file. They indicated me before. The state came in and totally reversed it after they removed three children from me and kept me from my grandchildren for more than a year. This is a pattern of practice from your agency.
The next card I have is for Lizzie Dawson Palmer. Okay. All right. The next card I have is Crystal Palmer.
Good evening. I'm from Newfield, New York. I didn't know I was going to be here tonight. I didn't know that, that's where I had to meet my mom to pick up my child. I just have a couple concerns. One of them is I did call the Department of Social Services to see what the qualifications were to be a foster parent, if I could take the foster classes. I called the foster care number, and they told me I had to speak with a specific employee. You told me not to say names. So I still haven't received a call back from them, and this was at the beginning of last week to find out what I have to do to be a foster parent. Only not just so much as my nieces and nephews, but, like, if I have any friends or family and this happens to again, I want to be able to step up when the time comes. Honestly, I have three kids of my own. Well, four. Three live with me full time, and I can't take in three more of my nieces and nephews, even though I love them dearly. But just, you know, just so I can have something underneath me. The other question I had, and I don't know if I should even bring this to here, but I do get help with my daycare, and I just find it odd that a person that's related to someone that watches their children can have as many kids as they want as long as they're related. Like, I know someone that was watching six children in her care and because they were related. I have three children. One of them goes to school. If I'm working an evening shift, my daughter can only be there for 3 hours at the daycare center, and that has caused my kids to be separated. My mom's had to go pick up this child during the week of no school just so she was only there for 3 hours. And because of the driving back and forth in the evening when I get out of work, I don't have enough time to go back and forth. So, like, my kids have seen each other at daycare for 3 hours at a time, but I'm, like, haven't seen her all week, you know? So I just don't understand where they get, like, I understand the legalities, but I just don't know if there's something that can be done to try to change that so that way siblings can stay together in the same daycare facility. And then, can you remind me what I wrote on my paper? Because I had three things.
DSS child support and okay. Obamacare assistance, is that?
Yes.
Daycare assistance, daycare. Excuse me.
And then the other thing is my oldest child does live with her father. And we battled in court for years over her. And I kind of just, I was young and I just kind of like gave up with the abuse and stuff. So, but every time I go back to court to try to have my support reduced and stuff because I do have other dependents and my income has gone down. He's never had to fill out a financial affidavit, and the judge allows that but refuses to reduce my support, and I just don't understand the concept there either, because I know it's based on your ability to earn, but when I was a manager at Aldi's, I made $8 more an hour than what I make as a customer service representative at Walmart, and I'm struggling too. So I just wanted to bring that to people's attention too, with the ability to earn and having one party have to fill out a financial affidavit, but not the other party that definitely has a lot more income in their home. So, and that's all I have to say for today. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all the blue cards I have. Are there other folks out there who would like to speak tonight? Yes, go to the microphone and state your name and your municipality, please.
Okay, I'm Chuck Roberts from Groton, and I recently married Bonnie, and I would like to know just what each one of you think a person should pay or put time in to get their family back together against the unfounded accusations by this Department of Social Service. And what about the people that can't fight these accusations that come up just hearsay? Accusations against a family. That's all I have to say, and thank you for your time.
I would just mention that we don't respond to public comment at this point, but I just thank you for the question. Is there anyone else who would like to speak tonight? Thank you very much. We'll move on to privilege of the floor for municipal officials. Are there any out there that wishes to speak? Up. Yes, we have one tonight. Bill Goodman from Town of Ithaca.
Good evening, everybody. As Chairman Lane just mentioned, I'm Bill Goodman, Town Board, Town of Ithaca, also Deputy Town Supervisor. Since I was here to support one of our town residents and a neighbor of mine at Eco Village, Gabe Shapiro, I'll give you a quick little update from the Town of Ithaca, particularly about a matter which some of you may have heard about already. And that's about the town's contributions to various agencies and organizations through our budget. Last week, our budget committee had a meeting, and they are going to be bringing to the town board for discussion fairly soon a proposal in the 2015 budget to cut by half a lot of the contributions we make to community organizations. The town, we'd received some projections last year when we were doing our budget last year, that if we continued along the path we were on in terms of using some of our fund balances to offset some of the tax levy increases we needed to make, that our general townwide fund balance would be zero in about 5 years. And we have gone over the tax cap in the past couple of years, but now with the governor's proposals around the tax cap for the next couple of years, we're debating whether to continue to go over. And so one of the things we are looking at in order not to run out of fund balance is cutting some of these discretionary contributions we've made in the past. As you know, we did cut TCAT from $50,000 to $25,000 for this year, 2014. And so in 2015, we'll be looking to cut a lot of other organizations by half, including something that might be of interest to you is our contribution to the county library. In the past, we've been making a $20,000 per year contribution, and so the budget committee is thinking about recommending a $10,000 contribution to the library in 2015, with the possibility that a lot of these contributions would then be cut to zero in 2016. So I just wanted to give you that update. And the town board is, as I said, going to be talking about this soon, so we can let all these organizations know as they're starting to prepare their budgets for 2015, and we don't spring it on them in October when we actually start working on our budget in October. So that's the quick update. Thanks for your time.
Bill, thank you for the update, I think.
Yeah.
We have a couple questions. Martha Robertson.
Martha. Hi, Bill. Thanks. Can you run down what agencies are in the budget now?
As off the top of my head, there's the county library and TCAT, which I've mentioned. Gadabout currently gets about 12,000. Lifelong, I think, gets 9,000. There's a number of youth-related agencies. Some of those, the budget committee has talked about not cutting, such as the REC partnership. But we also give, I think it's about $58,000-$60,000 a year to the Learning Web, and that's subject to being cut. Our contribution to the CSI for Community Science Institute for water testing, we're not talking about cutting that because that comes out of our water bills, not from the general tax. And then there's some contributions to the city, Cass Park. We make about $110,000 contribution every year to the city for Cass Park. That would be subject to being cut. And then some other small contributions. There's a number of other small contributions that the budget committee is looking at.
Thanks, Bill.
Anyone
thank
else?
You.
Bill, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Privilege of the floor for legislators. Let's try to keep our comments brief if we can. Let's try to respect the three-minute limit. I have Dooley Keeper first.
I was representing the county at the MPO meeting this afternoon, where we heard the plans of state DOT to bring the centerline audible roadway delineators to Tompkins County. That is the thing that feels like rumble strips. We're used to seeing them on the right side of highways. This is down the center line. And the state has been using this in counties for the last two or three years and has found it to be an amazingly cost-efficient way of preventing accidents, that the benefit is five times the cost. And although they were questioned about whether the cutting of depressions in the surface of the road might allow ice to form and break the surface, that the cost of repairing that is so insignificant compared to the cost of lives saved that they think it's a very good program now. And so I'm glad it's coming to Tompkins County finally. They did not have a list of which roads would be done first, but we will have that within about a week, so I will share that with you all. The other thing that we had at the MPO today was a handout, a briefing paper on the Transportation Trust Fund and how it is supposedly funded mainly through gasoline tax. There are some other things. And it is going to be broke in the near future, so it's an interesting discussion. by the former Binghamton MPO director. Very concise, and I will ask to have you all receive an electronic copy of that. One more thing on a different note, and maybe if, Carol, you're going to talk about this, I don't know, the Streets Alive Film Festival? No. On Thursday, March 13th at Cinemapolis, the doors opening at 7, there are a bunch of free shows, mostly taken by an organization, I think it's called Bike in Portland, Oregon. It's taken from the point of view of a bicycle rider. The shortest film is 28 seconds. The longest one is 8 minutes. As I said, it's free, and the first 75 people to come will get free bags of popcorn. It sounds like it would be actually a lot of fun to go to, so I wanted to let everyone know that.
Anyone else? Carol Chalk.
Yeah, I wasn't going to talk about that because I have three other things to briefly mention. One is I just want people to know that this session that I've been talking about that is being put on with more information about the New York State Energy Plan, hopefully the first of two sessions, but the first one with a real background about the plan is tomorrow night at our Tompkins County Library from 6:30 to 8:30. It is being sponsored by the Tompkins County EMC, TCOG, and the Social Ventures Fund are bringing in a gentleman named Jackson Morris. He is currently the Senior Energy and Climate Analyst with NRDC. It's a large environmental organization. But he's former senior policy analyst at the Pace Law School's Energy and Climate Center, which is where I first knew him as the author of a very nicely done report on New York State's renewable portfolio standard. What is it? How? What are the ideas in it? Are they being implemented? And so he also has comments on, to what extent is the new energy plan carrying through and trying to implement those things. But he and Dr. Bryce Smith, who's from SUNY Cortland, who's also a former senior scientist at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, both of them, or each of them, are equipped to sort of help us understand what are all those different acronyms and names of various entities at the state level that impact energy decisions, markets, funding that's available, policies, and what is this energy plan? And we can get more into that later. We have our own resolution about it. But this is a lot more depth than we'll be able to go into here. I'll pass this around with the details. And as I said, it is being sponsored by TCOG, so I encourage you to come. It should be an interesting session. I'll pass that around. You should have gotten in your box. I know I did. We're being invited next week on March 12th, finally, to the ribbon-cutting ceremony for Breckenridge Place down the block. That's at 11:30 on March 12th. Being put on jointly by Pathstone and Ithaca Neighborhood Housing Services and recognizing the architects, which is Holt, Trowbridge, Wolf Michaels Landscapes, T.G. Miller, and funding has been provided for that whole project by the Ithaca Urban Renewable Agency, the Tompkins County, the Community Housing Trust, that's us, the New York State Housing Trust Fund Corporation, NeighborWorks America, the Federal Home Loan Bank of New York, the Tompkins Trust Company, and Enterprise Community Investment. So it is, it's been quite a partnership of people and a beautiful building. The building itself, I'll mention, was named in honor of Juanita Breckenridge Bates, who was an early leader of the women's rights movement in Tompkins County and also a founding member of the City Federation of Women's Organizations, which was, the original owner of the women's community building that it's replacing. So I think, do people all get these in their boxes so I don't have to pass this?
They were mailed to us.
Huh?
They were mailed to us.
They were mailed. Boy, I didn't get. They didn't spend a stamp on me. Okay. At the Economic Development Committee meeting yesterday, towards the end of it, somebody mentioned that the Farm to Fork program, which had been sponsored by our tourism program, was holding one of their meetings. They haven't had that many. And I went and dropped by the promise of free food provided by farmers and chefs from our area was too much to resist after our meeting. And I came in partway through. It was just fascinating. It was a room full of people standing up. It had been mostly reception. They sent along copies of some of their literature that I will pass around, and there's enough copies for all of us. It's Farm to Fork. IthacaFork.com if you want more information. It was fascinating. Farmers, local farmers, and chefs and restaurant personnel from the area in a room together envisioning what could their partnerships look like. And it was, and they started to get into, I only caught a bit of it, but they started to get into everything from the fact that, boy, one of the restaurants, they need 15,000 pounds of onions, and they'd love to be buying local onions instead of mass-produced and trucked in from elsewhere, and what kind of match could be made, to what kinds of events could they hold together for both visitors and the local. There were all kinds of ideas coming out of this get together. It wasn't the first, but it's been a group that grew from five people sitting at a table at the North Star to, I think I counted 70 people in the room involved with this. So I just, it's worth checking out, and I'm sure we'll hear more from them in the future.
Thanks, Carol.
So here, I'll pass three that way and the rest this one.
Can we move on to Will Burbank?
Thanks, Mike. I'll be very quick. This afternoon, I sent out an email, which is a PDF of a letter that I and several other of you received from somebody who's currently in the Tompkins County Jail, raising specific concerns about conditions there. And I wanted everybody to see that. I suppose the appropriate committee to actually consider response would, of course, be public safety, but I want to make sure you all got that. And secondly, this week last week, I had the pleasure of once again dining at Loaves and Fishes. I hadn't done it in a while. And I was once again just amazed at the quality of the food and the community. And I'm mentioning it because I am sending out an invite to all of you to think about doing that. If you're ever down looking for lunch on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday around noon, or dinner on a Tuesday, Thursday at 5:30, wander across the park over to St. John's Episcopal Church. Go in there and just sit down. It is open to anyone, and you don't have to be in there. You do not have to be in need to eat there. In fact, they welcome and encourage every member of the community to come and partake. You will sit down, you'll have a good meal, and you also will meet people that many of the people that we are in the business of serving, and you probably have some really good conversations. You, in the not too distant future, probably will get a formal invite to come and be welcomed by the director, but just know it's always there, and I would encourage everybody to do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Will. Brian Robison.
Thanks, Mike. Just real quickly, I wanted to thank you, sir, from the town of Ithaca for making a report to us. I don't think we get those enough, and we're probably guilty of not going out and doing the reciprocating back. But the point he was making really resonated. I mean, a lot of times we have problems that are unique to one another and common to one another. This one's common, as we know. And it struck me that the governor's marketing or rhetoric or whatever it is you want to call it is beginning to strike nerves already. And I just wanted to point out that if that were to take place, obviously a lot of the agencies that are getting funding were like the place of last resort many times, and they may very well be coming to us to make up those differences. So, I think we all need to keep that those thoughts in the backs of our minds as we start to get into our own budget stuff.
Leslin McBean Claiborne.
That's all right. It's Women's History Month, and I do want to particularly say thank you to the county for 10 years now being supportive, involved of the Sister Friends luncheon. Imagine, if you will, there are 400-plus women gathered on Emerson Suites at Ithaca College, uplifting each other and celebrating the history of women. I want to encourage the department heads who are in the room, and if you're not a department head, but you work for the county and you are female, to please take those 2 hours and come to the Sister Friends event. Yes, Jay, I was talking to you. Let all the women in your office go, and Joe, to Sister Friends, which is held on March 13th from 11:30. The luncheon begins at 11:30 until 1:30. However, there's a lovely women's market. Our county has been involved in displaying, not only displaying, but also doing some recruitment. It's been a great place for diversity hire, for reaching out and meeting a very diverse population of people who could be potential talents that we can hire in our county. So more than anything else, I do want to thank the county for having been involved. This is 10 years that we have been hosting the Multicultural Resource Center. Under the leadership of Audrey Cooper, has been planning with a group of us, including Martha, to put on this event at Ithaca College. I suspect that the tickets sell out fast, so I suspect they might be sold out or they might be two left. I don't know, but people are still asking. Again, I just want to say thank you. It is March 14th. It is important for me to also acknowledge, in the spirit of diversity and inclusion, to say that we have never said that men cannot attend the event. We do say that there are 400-plus women at this event. Come at your own risk.
How could you pass up an invitation like that? Anyone else? Okay, let's move on. For my report tonight, I would mention we are trying to put together another joint meeting with Cortland legislators. There's been a lot of change in Cortland on that legislature. We tried to pick a date that didn't interfere with their standing committees or our standing committees, and we picked the 12th. And I realize that is over top of some other events. Sorry that that has to happen, but we all have to make choices and go to what we can. We'd like to have you come if you can. It's going to be, again, at A1 Restaurant in Dryden halfway, and it'll be on the 12th. The other thing I wanted to talk just a little bit about. Oh, excuse me, Kathy.
Thanks. I just wanted to ask, what's the agenda for this?
We're glad to talk about things that maybe you want to talk about, too. Any members here want to add to that? But we're going to talk a little bit about solid waste. We're going to talk about TC3 budget. And hopefully we're talking about our realignment effort respect to the governor's tax freeze and the NYSAC resolutions that we're trying to get out. So those are some of the things we want to talk about.
And would the open meetings law apply to this?
Certainly. Yeah.
So the public would be advised of the meeting and invited to attend?
If they'd like to come.
Great.
The other thing I want to talk a little bit about is our last meeting. It was probably one of the most difficult meetings that I can remember as a member of the legislature. We had quite a group of folks here who were very passionate about different topics, particularly the jail renovation issue. We can look back in hindsight and say, should we have done one thing differently or another thing differently? I think we did the best we could. It's very difficult if you have some members of the public who are not willing to abide by some of our rules and interrupt folks and basically act ill-mannered. But our choices were to call in a deputy, for example, and ask them to escort people to the door. We didn't really want to do that. It's something we haven't done before. I, for one, and I think this legislature cherishes the fact that we do allow privilege of the floor for people. We have some basic rules. We'd like people to tell us what they think and to speak clearly and not yell at us. But we often have situations which bring a lot of passion. But we can't let one meeting or one event change our goal, which is to allow the people out there to speak to us about any topic. So here, one meeting later, and we only have a few people that talk to us tonight. So it can go up and down. But I want to thank each of you for your patience with the crowd last time. I know it was noisy. It was pressing, and it may have been uncomfortable at times. But despite that, we conducted our business and got through it. And I appreciate the efforts of all of you. Resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda. Jim Dennis.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, I would like to add a resolution. It is not on the agenda. It's Resolution I. It is recommending an alternative to the two-year property tax freeze proposed in the 2014-15 executive budget that will lead to permanent and historic property tax reductions by eliminating the cost of state-mandated spending imposed on county property taxpayers.
Is there a second to add that? Brian Robinson. Any discussion? All in favor of adding that to the agenda?
Aye.
Those opposed? I think that's unanimous.
Thank you.
Joe, I skipped right over you.
Nobody noticed and nobody objected.
County Administrator Joe Mariana.
Thanks, Mike, and it's actually a good segue, the resolution that is coming on the agenda. I wanted to report on a couple of things, beginning with the effort to propose an alternative to the governor's plan to have a property tax freeze, and just give you a sense of what's going on that front. Including locally, Mike and I met with Barbara Lifton late last week to brief her on the specifics of our plan. I think it's fair to say that before we got too many of the bullet points out, she already was able to recite the other parts of the presentation. Clearly, she has read it. She seems to subscribe to it fully. She has said that she's passed on our ideas to the speaker and is trying to raise those issues in caucus. I thought it was a very productive conversation. She did encourage us to pass a resolution. One reason it's here tonight is because she suggested those things do count in Albany. So she asked for a resolution to help give her some foundation to work from. So, again, I thought that was a good meeting with Barbara Lifton. That follows a meeting that we had kind of on an impromptu basis with Senator O'Mara as a part of a town meeting a couple of weeks ago. I think Mike reported on that when that happened, but we were able to bend his ear on this plan at that time. You may recall that very quickly after we had suggested our alternative, Senator O'Mara indicated that he was supportive of that kind of a plan, so we were able to reinforce that with him. We're also working on a conference call with Senator Seward this week. And I think importantly, and that leads to a kind of a second part of this report, TCOG met last Thursday, and devoted about a third of its meeting to a discussion about how to organize the effort to oppose the property tax freeze, not because anybody wants property taxes to go up, but because of all the consequences that we've talked about in this room several times now. There is a small work group that has been formed. The work group will be a part of the conversation we have with Senator Seward next week. We thought it would be important to have representatives of each level of local government in on these conversations, and in fact, we will. So we will have a city, county, town, and village rep in this conversation with Senator Seward, and as we continue to lobby, we will try to make it a combined effort like that also. I think it's important the state knows how deep the sentiment is regarding the concerns that local governments have with the proposal. I sent around today an editorial that was in the Albany Times-Union, and I think the message is getting out, and I think the Albany Times-Union is a really important paper because they read it in Albany. And I think in there you've seen some of the things that we've talked about ad nauseum sometimes. I just want to recite a couple of things that were in there, beginning with the opening paragraph that says, Governor Andrew Cuomo says property taxes are too high. State lawmakers, particularly Republicans, say the state's mandates on local governments are too onerous. Well, here's something they can all do. Take over Medicaid. And it can't be any clearer or more direct than that. And it challenges the state to provide property tax relief by doing what we've asked them to do, which is to step up and pay their bills and cover the cost of mandates. So I don't know how effective all this is going to be in the end. Clearly this message, the governor's message, does resonate. You can fit it, as we always say, on a bumper sticker. It's very hard to deal with that. At the same time, I think we are helping to articulate some of the issues that will go along with that plan and feel actually pretty good that NYSEC seems to have embraced this as its approach that's being picked up in some of the media. That's a good thing. So I think we'll all shake out. I think this will be an on-time budget, so by the first of next month, we will know whether it's in or out of this budget. So with respect to topic number one, that's the report on how we were doing on that front. It's been a while since I've talked to you about a different topic, which is the health consortium, the health benefits consortium, which is now 3 years old. I just wanted to let you know of a development that's occurring there. First of all, the consortium is now a $30 million business. So it's a major undertaking. It has saved taxpayers, and this is a shared service that doesn't count. It saved the taxpayers, if it's $1 million in the first year, $3 million over the last 3 years. It's a good estimate of what it saved. It has branched out to include now the city of Cortland outside of this county. Wow. So in terms of its success, and the bottom line success is really good too. Reserves are where they need to be and beyond. They've paid back all those initial deposits. So the consortium is operating as we had hoped it would. What it's finding, though, is that to comply with Article 46 of the tax law and requirements that have been identified in an audit, there's a lot of administrative work that has to be done in this consortium, a lot. A burden that exceeds what we can reasonably ask a volunteer chair to do, even though Don Barber, God bless him, has carried this burden for 3 years now. The consortium several months ago suggested maybe it's time to look at an executive director of some kind to carry that administrative burden. It had formed an ad hoc committee that was chaired by Anita Fitzpatrick and included representatives of the city, the town of Ithaca, and the unions to look at, does this idea make any sense? What's the best way to provide administrative support? Over the last couple of weeks, that committee recommended to the board that, in fact, it should consider an executive director, but on a part-time basis. It's not a full-time, doesn't seem to be a full-time need, and on a contractual basis, to be able to hire out on contract, at least initially, someone who can handle the administrative work, serve as the executive director, and be accountable to the board. And the board accepted that recommendation at its last meeting, which was last Thursday. So soon there'll be an RFP issued to search out someone who could serve this executive director role. The board hasn't absolutely closed the door on other options. They'll continue to look, but they want to see what will happen as a result of this RFP. So I wanted to make you aware of that. I think it just indicates the maturity of this consortium now.
Are you done, Joe? Can I go to questions?
Well, I just had one more topical area, but this would be a good time if there are questions about the consortium.
Actually, I think Martha had a question about your earlier comment.
You said you're working on a conference call with Senator Seward. Did you mention a school board, school representative?
We haven't included a school person at this point. I guess the assumption is that their lobbying effort is pretty strong and pretty united, that maybe they can speak for themselves on this issue. So the discussion we had at TCOG was only local governments, not schools.
Okay. I think that might actually be counterintuitive and would strengthen the message if municipalities are together with schools. The issues are a little different for every layer of government, but I think that's you know, the Albany Times Union editorial is a great step. I mean, it's not like this is new, but it seems like the way you formulated it, Joe, is really, you really struck, you know, a message that people were ready to hear and are ready to carry. And, again, thank you very much for doing that. So maybe this time it'll make a difference.
Yeah. Don't put a name on this. This is something that has, again, the mandate relief is something that counties have been advocating for years. So it's just, again, another run at that. But it does seem to be getting traction.
Will, you had a question?
I did. And it was about the RFP for the health consortium. Are you envisioning this position basically being a contract relationship? Or
yes. Okay. Yeah. There was a lot. In fact, that's what has taken a great deal of time to think through. There were two issues. Should it be full-time or part-time? And the conclusion was we could do it on a part-time basis. The second was, should it be an employee or should it be on a contract basis? A lot of discussion about that, and you can imagine the trade-offs of one versus the other. In the end, the decision has been to go with the contract, in part because of the complexities of an employee. It is almost a certainty that the position would need to be a civil service position. There are a lot of encumbrances that would go along with that. So at least as this gets started, the group came to believe that the best way to approach it is through a contract. We don't think it's going to be a firm. I think it's likely to be an individual who would want to do something like this on a part-time basis and willing to do it on contract.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Jim? I'm sorry, Nathan, were you first?
Yeah.
Nathan, then Jim.
Joe, how many employees are under the consortium now?
You know, Nathan, it's in excess of 2,000. So it's, again, I think it started out at 2. It's grown beyond that. There were some holdouts. I think the only municipalities locally now that don't participate would be Newfield and the Village of Lansing. I think those are the only two locals that don't.
And then now you have representatives from the healthcare field that are on that.
Yes.
On the board. Have they talked about the patient-centered medical home model? And if so, yeah. What has happened with that conversation?
It is a continuing conversation. I don't think there are any initiatives that have been launched because of that. It is something that the board has expressed an interest in pursuing, and one of its frustrations has been it doesn't have that internal focus to be able to really look at it carefully, come back with recommendations, and then move on. So in part, the call for a director is tied to initiatives like that.
And just for education purposes for the legislature, what that would mean is that you would designate a health system, you know, probably Cuga Med and its physicians, and they would help manage the population of workers as part of the consortium. So, you know, this is usually businesses will have all their employees under their health insurance sign up with a particular system, and then what they'll do is they'll manage that population and, you know, identify people that are high risk for heart disease, high risk for type 2 diabetes, and we'll start managing those populations early on. And it involves a lot of technology. It's a lot of complicated algorithms to understand which populations are at risk and whatnot. But it's a great preventative way to deal with medicine, but also to reduce costs for the employer. And so that's why I was asking.
And this is something maybe we should talk. We could take this into
medical.
Yeah. We could talk about this at GEO. In fact, it's been a while since I brought the consortium topics to GEO. We could talk about this. There was a proposal some time ago that seemed to kind of drop away that would have involved an upfront investment, a cost, pretty significant cost by the consortium.
I think that was even when I was...
I think so. And then we kind of backed away, and now it's really trying to feel our way through to see how we can approach it in maybe a more cost-effective way.
Yeah.
So it's still alive.
Jim Dennis.
Joe, does a hiring of a part-time director still keep Rick Snyder in the money portion?
It does.
Of that?
Yeah, he'll continue to do that. And, you know, the county's reimbursed for the time that we spend doing the books. So it's neutral out of pocket. This is really, and again, Don Barber has assumed an enormous burden, administrative burden, and this will relieve that.
Mark.
Nathan, did you just advertise Hugin Medical Center to...
I didn't know. That was the most neutral way that I could talk about it.
I wondered if anybody from, you know, the other one has heard. Does that involve in-network and out-of-network? I mean, if that were to become the model here, does it
And that's part of what makes it very complicated. You know, and that's why I mentioned QGMED, because you would have to have both a primary care and beyond type of system that could serve that population, where most people are likely to be part of that, be patients of that system throughout the continuum of care. So that's what makes it really difficult. Now, it's mostly, though, based in primary care. So you could, as long as most of the people that are employees are using the same network for primary care, then it's mostly doable at that point.
Sounds like a great topic for GEO.
Yeah.
Joe, you had a third topic you
wanted
to speak
about? I do. I have a third topic, and then this I can do very quickly. Sometimes when you pass things, you probably wonder what happens to it after you pass it. And I just wanted to report that we've been working with WDIC on a number of things that relate to the diversity and inclusion policy that was passed a few months ago. So I wanted to report progress on a number of fronts. First, one of the items in the policy is the development of metrics that we can use to measure kind of our status and our progress on both diversity and inclusion. So we've made really good progress in terms of developing some diversity metrics. Our ITS folks have done a great job in getting things to come out of our computers that will help us be able to track profile of our workforce, who's hired, who has left county employment, and so forth. And we'll be bringing those to WDIC at the next meeting. The inclusion metrics are a little trickier. They're harder. So we're continuing to work on those, but at least we're making progress on the diversity metrics. WDIC has flagged limited English proficiency as an issue for it, and it caused us a little concern because we were afraid that when people came to see us and wanted to participate in meetings and didn't really have a mastery of English or had impairments, we wouldn't be able to accommodate them. I think the good news is that we found that in almost every instance, departments have procedures and processes that they follow to address that. But we also found that we really haven't harmonized those at all. We haven't codified what we do. So Karen Baer is working on that, and we're working with WDIC on that front. Paul is involved in several things, and again, this is with WDIC and Leslin very much involved. Reading discussion group we've talked about is taking off. It launches on the 27th of March, and you'll be getting some information on that. We're working with the Diversity Consortium on a common curriculum for diversity and inclusion training. Paul has been involved in that. And finally, on that front, we've talked about climate survey. We've issued an RFP for an entity to work on the climate survey with us to make that happen this year. So I just want you to know that, again, sometimes you pass things and you probably wonder what in the world has happened. And I want you to know we're working well with WDIC to move along some of the things that were in that policy. And that's my report.
Thanks, Joe. I would also point out that in your packet, in your red folders tonight, in the correspondence list, there's another county, a sister county, Orleans, has passed an ISAC resolution, which was based on our resolution that Joe brought forward. And the one we're going to be talking about tonight. So it's getting legs.
May I, Mr. Chair, just for the record, say sure. that was Joe's report and the WDIC report, so you don't need to call me.
Well, I still may come around, in case you think of something. Jonathan Wood, county attorney.
I just want to say a few things in advance of your meeting with the Cortland County Legislature. Last week, Barbara Ekstrom and Leo Riley from the Solid Waste Division and I went to Cortland County, and we met with their county administrator and their solid waste director, who in their county is really the public works commissioner. And as some of you have probably heard, some legislators in Cortland County have been interested in maybe doing something with Tompkins County with waste, with solid waste. To kind of summarize where we were at both before and after and through our conversation. The county currently has a contract where, this being Tompkins County, where a company picks up the garbage or solid waste and brings it to a landfill. What we're paying, and I can't remember the exact number, but it's about in the $20 a ton range for landfill, for the landfilling part. That doesn't include the transportation part, but for the landfilling part, it's about $20 a ton. And we are going out for bid because our current contract ends next month. So we're going out for a bid again for that service. We expect that the low bids will be in about the same area, about the $20 a ton. Cortland County charges $60 a ton, over $60 a ton. They would not lower their fee for Tompkins County because it would mean they'd have to lower their fee for their own county. So the idea of our solid waste going to Cortland County is economically doesn't really make sense, as they believe as well as we believe. But however, what they are planning and what they're hoping to do is pretty interesting, although it's not necessarily supported by everyone on their county legislature, is that they have been working on an agreement with OCRA, which is the Onondaga County Resource Recovery Agency. And under this agreement, if it goes through, which they're very hopeful it will, is Cortland County will take its solid waste to OCRA, and then Cortland County will take the ash from OCRA's burn plant and use their current landfill to keep that ash. That would, for them, I mean, they're losing a lot of money, have been losing a lot of money on their landfill for many years, and that would be a savior for them if that were to happen. And it would also allow them to take advantage of the many recycling and other programs and reuse programs that they have as part of the Onondaga County program, which they really don't have in Cortland County. So they also feel it would be a large increase in recycling and reuse for them. So they're hoping that that's what will happen. And we have, you know, a series of further communications which we have for them. But realistically, not only does it not really work economically for our solid waste to go there for either of us, but it also is not really consistent with what they hope to do. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that every single legislator on their legislature has that same thought. But that's certainly their thought, and they certainly feel that the majority of their legislature will support that.
Thank you. Questions? Carol Chalk.
Yeah, that's a huge discrepancy in cost. Do we know any more information about whether those two costs are comparing apples and apples, or whether there are environmental standards, for example, that are being met in Cortland that aren't being met where we're bringing it now?
Yeah, we do know. The function of, I mean, they're both, wherever we go, as well as Cortland County, are DEC-approved landfills. The difference and the huge difference in the cost of landfilling is basically the economics of the landfill. The landfills where we are currently taking, and most counties and most municipalities are going to now, are very large private landfills. And therefore, when you're distributing the cost on a ton basis, you have a pretty low cost per ton basis. The problem that Cortland County has, and fortunately we as Tompkins County don't have, is they're stuck with a very old, small landfill where the cost per ton is going to be very high. So it's just a basic matter of economics. It's not, has nothing to do with one being environmentally superior or anything. It's simply the solid waste business has gone in a way, and recycling too, actually, where the economics of doing, of landfilling, and also the economics of much recycling, is that you need to do it in large amounts because the upfront fixed cost of putting a landfill are so great that you better have a large landfill where you can get a lot of waste versus a small landfill where you can only do a small amount of waste. So, and the difference is huge. It is the difference between $20 a ton and $60 a ton.
It's the, I think it's the bond payments, too, that they have to.
Right, but that's what it is. It's the, the bond payment reflects
old,
the cost of the landfill.
Just a follow-up, can we define old? I was under the impression that they had fairly recently built this new state-of-the-art landfill with expansion capability for the future.
I can't tell
you. Is that older than I realized?
How old it is.
Yeah, no, it's I can't say exactly, but it's older. No one these days builds a landfill that size. I mean, the economics of building landfills is you have to build them very large because of the upfront costs of putting in a landfill. There's so many millions of dollars that unless you have a lot of waste coming, you're not going to be able to. Like Michael said, the bonding cost, the cost of putting in that landfill is so many millions of dollars that unless you have a huge amount of tonnage coming, it's going to be really prohibitively expensive. And that's what happens with some old counties that are stuck with old landfills. The economics are just terrible because they're competing against landfills which are 10 and 20 times as large.
Martha.
Thank you. Jonathan, remind me where we take our garbage.
At the moment, it's going to it's going to Seneca Meadows right now. That's because it was the low bid. Given the distances, there are not that many landfills which could be the low bid, and Seneca Meadows is huge, so it's certainly possible that it would again be the low bid. We haven't always taken it there. For a while, we took it to Onondaga County. But basically, we bid it. Seneca Meadows is the low bid. We will not continue unless that's a low bid again.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Our Director of Finance, Rick Snyder, is not here tonight. He called me and said he is very sick, and he certainly sounded it on the phone. We wish him well, and hopefully he'll be back with us at our next meeting. Is there any report that anyone for him? Joe, do you have anything for him?
No.
Okay. Well, let's move on. Let's go to the consent agenda. Have some advisory board appointments. To the Environmental Management Council, Gary Stewart. To the Agriculture and Farmland Protection Board, Donald Specker and John Fleming. The Planning Committee... The Economic Development Committee approved Andrew Zepp for the Strategic Tourism Planning Board today. Somebody want to move those? Sorry, they're part of the consent agenda. Let me get through the rest of the resolutions. On the consent agenda, we have Resolution A, reducing standard work week for social services attorney position. That's ID 4637. From the Government Operations Committee, we have Resolution B, approval of appointment of Tompkins County Council of Governments, ID 4627, and Resolution C, appointment of Temporary Board of Assessment Review, Administrative Hearing Panels, that's 4658. From the Public Safety Committee, we have that's off. And that's all on the consent agenda. Is there a motion, with the exception of Resolution D, for the appointments and the other resolutions? Leslin McBean Claiborne. Is there a second? Seconded by Dooley Kiefer. Discussion? All those in favor? Those opposed? That's unanimous. Who have we got waiting for what? Jay, I see you. Anybody else waiting for something tonight from our staff? Can we go to government operations first so we can let Jay go?
Yes, we can. All right.
Nathan Shinagawa, Chair.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Mike. Yes, I'd like to move Resolution G, authorizing a public hearing on proposed local law of 2014, a local law to enact Section 470 of the New York State Real Property Tax Law, and I so move.
Seconded by Dave McKenna.
All right.
Go ahead.
And so you will all recall that this was a resolution that came to the last meeting about giving a... tax abatement for properties that have LEED certification, a limited tax abatement on the taxable value of $100,000. And so we brought that to committee to clarify some things inside of the law, and now it has been brought back here. And so, but I've asked Jay to come because I believe there are still some open questions about this, and so I wanted to have him as the expert be able to answer those.
Okay, are there questions? Will Burbank.
Hi, Jay. I support the goal of this resolution, but I would like to know a little bit more about what it will actually cost us. And I threw this question out when we had a little meeting of PEAK right before, and we may not know that, but I'm just wondering if we have any experience from other counties, you know, what would be the actual cost and the expected number of people who would be taking advantage of this?
Well, it won't cost us anything, mainly because it's only on new construction. So it won't be any loss of revenue or any shifting of taxes. It would just be simply you're not getting as much of that increase in the tax base in the first year. So I said if we had 50 new homes within the county that are all LED certified and could be fully exempt up to that $100,000 limit that's in here, we would end up losing about $51,750 in tax dollars. If it was fully taxable, it would be about $86,000 based upon a 6.9% tax rate. And we'd be exempting off about $34,000 of that. So you're abating, you know, 20% of it, 25% of it. And that's just for the residential properties. You know, some of the larger projects that may have it, such as McGuire's import dealership, would have been eligible for this. But you're gaining, you know, a couple million dollars of tax base and abating that $100,000. So that would make that percentage be less that you're abating as opposed to that 20%.
So just sort of following up, you know, you say there's no cost, but it's an opportunity cost. We could be getting that and those projects, some portion of those projects might be happening regardless because there is already a built-in incentive for having a more energy-efficient unit. Do we have any information, and I assume this is happening in New York State. It was allowed by the state government, right? Is there any other counties that have done this? Or?
I don't know offhand. I haven't talked to anybody to see what they've went and had any experience with it. One thing that I've found out is whenever you anticipate what this is, the actual end cost isn't anywhere close to it. Even with the capital improvements to residential properties in the city of Ithaca, 7 properties benefit from that. Even anybody who gets a building permit pretty much could benefit on their one or two family houses. As to why they don't take advantage of it, I don't know. But, you know, probably the biggest hang-up is people may build to a LEED certification, but they don't actually go that extra step to become certified, which is what something would be required for this exemption. Okay. And I don't know if that trade-off to go that extra step is worth getting the exemption or not.
Okay, thank you.
Carol, then Martha.
Yeah, it is my understanding that in order to become actually LEED certified, you have to pay somebody, an engineer that is approved by the USB Green Building Council to certify that you followed all the green building requirements. It's one of the things we've talked about here under whether we ought to do LEED certification or find something that is cheaper to certify. Is my understanding correct that the portion of construction that would be abated would be just on that portion of the value that contributes to the LEED status, or would it be on the whole construction?
I would assume it would be on the whole construction. If there's multiple buildings that are part of it, then only the part that would be classified as LEED. But if you had a two-family house, and I guess I'm a little confused by the question, but if you had a two-family house, it would be both units would be classified and would be part of that abatement.
To make it more concrete, let's say I
I built a house for $1 million, and $200,000 of that was for, assuming I could do that, $200,000 of that was the incremental cost to make it LEED certified, as opposed to just build the house I was going to build anyway. Is the abatement on the whole million, or is it on the $200,000?
It would be on the whole million, but that's why the cap is in there at $100,000 to kind of address what is that incremental cost of going to that LEED classification. It would be nice if we could do a 20%, which is kind of that range. It's kind of all over the board what I saw, to go that incremental cost to go to silver or platinum. But we had to go with a dollar figure, so that's where that $100,000 is to address that incremental cost to go to that LEED classification.
Can I ask one more then?
Sure.
So what's the least expensive house or renovation to a house that would be viable to be putting in LEED status? You know, you're building a $100,000 house. You just don't have the kind of money to put into the certification. What threshold?
I went with the $250,000, $300,000 house is probably the most typical new house that we're seeing built on the market today. So with that, you know, somewhere in that 30% abatement level, when you look at $100,000 and a $300,000 house.
Martha, then Nate.
So what if I have a house that's right now, it's, let's say, $200,000, and I put a system into it that makes it qualify for LEED. So, you know, so maybe it's now 250. But no, wait, let me back up. A couple of years ago, you said that the exemption for solar or wind installations, it wasn't a problem for us to remove that exemption to dealing with the wind farm, because you weren't seeing any increased value based on solar and wind installations on properties. Like two houses that are comparable and one has solar panels. You weren't seeing any increase in value. So is this different, or are you now seeing that there's an increase in value? Or are you basing this on the construction costs that are included in the LEED project?
It's not different, but if you're building a new house and it's to that LEED certification, you know, we would still look at the market value of the property and then abate off that $100,000. If you were to renovate your property, probably the money that you put in to receive that certification isn't going to be what you see as an increase in market value. It's more of a marketing, I don't want to say issue, but a marketing point that your property is LEED certified now. You know, the market value between a property that isn't LEED certified and is LEED certified, there probably isn't a much difference, if any difference, between those two properties.
So you're not seeing an adjustment to value based on having that certification?
Correct. And it's something most people are seeing. A couple of my appraisers were at the New York State appraisal conference this last fall, and you know they're not seeing any definable appreciation and value between a green building and a non-green building. And in fact, four of my other appraisers are taking a class tomorrow through the realtors of Tompkins County about appraising green buildings, just to see where that's gone and what people are seeing.
Okay. And does any other county, maybe, did you already answer, does any other county in the state have a law like this?
I'm sure they do. I don't know offhand exactly. There's not a easy repository of what other places have adopted.
All right. I'm just sorry. One other question for Jonathan. Jonathan, is the language in here, especially looking at Section 1, it's so spare. Is that clear enough? Does that clearly describe what's relevant here?
You mean Section 1? It just says the exemption.
Legislative intent to provide an, I'm look on package page 15.
Uh-huh.
It's the intent of this local law to provide an exemption from county real property taxes for newly constructed or the renovated portion of buildings that meet LEED certification standards.
I mean, I think that's accurate. I mean, how it actually works is a little complicated, but I, the legislative intent, I think, is actually, totally accurate. I mean, I've seen a couple of these, and this seems to pretty much conform to what other counties have done. And obviously, I don't think most people get into reading the specifics of the law. They understand the exemption as explained by Jay and his staff. So I'm not sure that, that it needs any particular clarification. I mean, the whole concept is somewhat, I think, for people to fully understand. I mean, they'll understand that there's a potential discount by having LEED status, but how exactly it works, I think virtually everybody's going to have to go to the office and ask.
Okay, so just so I know how it works, so again, that $200,000 house, and I've just added $50,000 worth of something to make it qualify. Is my abatement $50,000 or is it $100,000?
No, if we then said your $200,000 house is now worth $250,000, you would have an abatement only on that $50,000 of that increase.
That's what doesn't feel like it's clear enough here somehow. But if people are going to have to ask Jay anyway, that's fine.
I just want to point out to everybody that all we're doing tonight is authorizing a public hearing. We aren't adopting this. I want to go to Nathan and then Carol and then Peter.
That answered my second question. My first question is, Jay, I mean, realistically, I mean, how many houses are LEED certified in Tompkins County right now? Because LEED has been around for a while, so I would...
I don't have any gut feeling as to what. I don't think there's that many. I don't think people have taken that step to become LEED certified and go through all of those hoops and paying the extra money to do so.
Right. I mean, it is a major hurdle to do that.
I think people would, excuse me, build to those standards, and they know it. But to get the plaque on their wall, I don't think they've done that.
Yeah.
Carol.
Yeah, two things. One is, are you anticipating that those who are involved in rental housing, that would be eligible for this as well, not just commercial or single family houses? That's correct. Okay. It might be helpful when this does come back to us for a vote or the night of the hearing, whichever it seems to be most appropriate, to have somebody come and talk to us about what it involves to get LEED certification. When this came up on F&I, when we were talking about it with one of our buildings, I believe there was some confusion about what it takes to get LEED certification. And it's, we're talking about it as though it's an add-on, as though you could put a panel on your roof or a heater. And it's more complicated than that. The LEED process involves how you do the construction, how you dispose of the waste, what carpet you buy, whether it's, you know, so it's, it, there's a lot of standards involved, and it's the watching of it during the construction to see that those things are followed correctly. So it's not as easy as you think to just sort of have somebody come in and inspect and say, yes, you put in the right water heater. I'll also just point out for that if people want to see a 50-unit LEED Platinum building, they can go to that ribbon cutting next Wednesday. I'm hoping we'll see more of this, because if an affordable housing organization can afford to do it, hopefully those who are in other kinds of businesses will be able to afford to do it in the future. And if we pass this, then it, at some point, if we want to reevaluate, if we feel like we're it's been built into the mainstream and we're losing too much assessed value, at what point would we be able to reconsider?
At any point, you can then go ahead and reduce that cap or opt back out of the exemption. And if you do grant it, you know, I'll be more than willing as part of my annual report to GO to say here's the number of new exemptions and the amount that was granted and amount that was abated.
I want to take Peter Stein, then Kathy Luz Herrera, then I'd like to get to a vote. Kathy's going to pass. Peter Stein.
I vowed I wouldn't say anything because I didn't understand this before, but now I really don't understand it. I thought that I heard you say that you don't see any additional value that's given to a house because it's LEED certified. And then you also said that the abatement that we were going to give is on the for a house that is not built from scratch with LEED certification, that's renovated to get LEED certification, that for that house you would be giving an exemption on the increased value because of the LEED certification had been achieved. But then it sounds to me like nobody will ever get any abatement. I mean, those two things seem, and unless I'm missing something, it sounds to me like you're saying there won't be any change in the value, but you're going to give an abatement for the change in the value. So that means an abatement of zero. So I don't quite get it.
For new houses, there would be that abatement. For the existing house, and you just did something to change that existing house, in Martha's example, I went with it and said if we did increase it to 250, but we probably wouldn't increase it if you just did minor renovations to bring it up to that LEED.
So then this is going to apply to a newly built building that you're talking about.
New building or an addition.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
New lumber.
Okay. Can we go ahead and vote on this then? Again, this is Resolution G, authorizing a public hearing on proposed local law to enact Section 470 of the New York State Real Property Tax Law. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, Jay. Liz Cameron, are you here for the fees resolution? Peter, I wonder if you might take Resolution F.
Yeah, where am I here? Okay, Resolution F, ID 4631, authorizing changes in selective environmental health division fees for 2014, the health department.
Is there a second? Seconded by Kathy Luz Herrera. Do you want to speak to it, Peter?
Or just very shortly. My understanding of this is that the head of the health department made an assessment change. I'm all mixed up now. The health department charges a fee for various things that the fees had not been done recently according to the way they might have been, and so he did it again, and it was going to require a significant increase for the fee that they paid for grassroots, but that was, if I understood him properly, that was consistent with the additional cost that the health department was going to have to spend policing that or taking care of it. So that sounded to me like straightforward.
Wilbur Bank.
And that Liz has waited patiently. I'm wondering if we could invite her to say a little bit about what specifically the health department has to do in that situation.
Liz, please.
So you have your questions mainly on the grassroots, because there are a couple of other fee changes in there.
So to try to explain it, grassroots, we used to issue permits as a campground. They have three campgrounds there, and their fees were, I think, approximately $1,500. They varied depending on the number of campsites. We talked with the New York State Department of Health, and under the interpretation now, we need to regulate them as a mass gathering, which we have never done before. We had a proposed mass gathering fee on our fee schedule for years and years and years because it is a permit we can be required to issue, and the fee for that was, I believe, $4,000 per day and $6,000 for the plan review, which for grassroots would be $18,000, which is quite a big increase from what we have been charging them in previous years. We also found that looking through the records that we did have, a lot of the basis for that fee was that we are required to have a 24-hour command post and staff it. With discussions with New York State DOH, the area, the office or whatever, has to be available to us, but we're not required to staff it. So that is a significant decrease in the cost that we would incur in putting forward this permit. So as a result, we reanalyzed it, did a best guess at what our costs would be since we have never gone through this process yet, and proposed the fee that's before you now, which is a slight increase over what grassroots paid last year, but we think is they're happy with that fee. And as an interim fee, we felt that it was fair and consistent with fees we charge other users.
Can you mention the amount of the fee?
I'm sorry. It's in your packet. So the fee was $1,500 for the permit itself. They are also required to submit a plan review or a plan, and then that fee would be another $1,000. So for a total of $2,500. Sorry, I thought that's what it was, but wanted to confirm it.
So,
Will?
So, Liz, and I recall from the discussion in committee, you essentially created this one fee for this one event because there's essentially nothing else currently like that in the county. Is that correct? Did I remember that correctly, that it was this?
We're creating this for existing mass gatherings. Grassroots is a very well-run organization, and they have a lot of procedures already established. So we're creating it for existing operations, which is only grassroots in Tompkins County. If we had a totally new facility come in or a new event want to come in, we wouldn't want to be charging them that same fee. We'd need to look at it because we'd have a lot more work to do in that situation.
And finally, the function is basically ensuring, checking water supplies and toilet and facilities and whatever, sanitation and just basic health. Is that?
We are the health department, and so, yes, we are basically checking to make sure there's sanitary conditions at grassroots. What you mentioned is primarily what we do in the field. There is also a significant plan review component to a mass gathering that wasn't previously there under a campground. So some of the plans have been approved through different, New York State Department of Health, a different part of Department of Health. So we'll be sort of relying on them. We have to look at what security plans they have. So there's a number of other plans that we also will be reviewing to make sure that public health is protected.
Thank you.
Mike Sigler, and then Nathan, did you have your hand up, or were you scratching your head there?
I was scratching my head.
All right, we'll go from to Mike Sigler, then we'll go to Peter Stein and Martha Robertson.
Did you say there was three campgrounds, though? So would it have been $1,500?
Microphone. Our campground fee is totally different than our mass gathering fee. So we had
Mike, your microphone.
So the total for the so we assessed a fee previously for grassroots for their on-site campground, their next door campground, which is immediately adjacent, and then their off-site one. And so each of those has a base fee and then an additional fee per campsite. So it varied from year to year. The total for all of, and there is also a seasonal discount. So the total for all of those three campsites was approximately $1,500. It varied year to year depending on the total number of campsites they had authorized.
So really for a campground, it's like $500.
For the campgrounds at Grassroots, yes. But there is a base fee and then a per site fee.
Peter Stein.
Very quickly, am I correct that the general principle is that we recover our costs, no more, no less? Is that correct?
No, is
it? We do adjust. It's difficult to say that we have a general principle on our fees. We try to do a fair cost recovery. We do not recover all of our costs through the health department through that. The county gives us part of the funds. We collect some through fees. We collect some through state aid. At the health department, we issue basically two types of fees. One is an operating fee, which like restaurants have to have, temporary residences, hotels have to have, public water supplies have to pay a fee to operate for us to review them. Then there's also a plan review fee, which like new restaurants, new water supplies, new on-site sewage systems, they have to submit a plan. If you have a new campground, you have to submit a plan. Our plan review fees, we have an engineer look at the plans or somebody certified. For those, we generally do try to recover close to all of our costs. We're in the neighborhood of 80%. For our operating fees, there's a lot of other factors that get involved, and overall, we recover probably about 20%. It varies a lot. We recover more in some types of permits than we do in others. In some areas, we're mandated by the state with what we can charge, and then we're stuck with that. So it's not like for our children's camps, it's a state-mandated fee. We recover a very small amount of our costs in that area.
Thank you. I have Martha, then Kathy, and then let's please vote.
Liz. So you say the original mass gathering was like 18,000, but when it was re-evaluated and you said you didn't have to have somebody on staff 24/7, you could go down to the net of 2,500. So is there, if something goes wrong during the time when it's not staffed, is that you've got people on call in the department, is that covered?
What we actually put in is a fee, a basic fee of $1,500 plus $80 per hour, per staff hour, in the event that there is some type of incident that we have to respond to after the permit is issued.
Okay, so that's just one of your on-call, somebody who's on call that weekend.
We have somebody on call every weekend.
Right,
but
right.
Yes.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I voted for this in committee, and I'm going to vote for it now. Just I want to summarize for my own self that it appears that for some folks there's a concern that the increase is too much, and for some folks there's a concern that they're getting a bargain. I think this is a good step, and it's my understanding that if next year reveals that, you know, there's some big changes that need to be made, that the health department will do that. I think this is a good adjustment. Is that sort of where we're going?
That pretty much summarizes it. We don't have a good basis for making a fee this year since we've never done this. So we did the best estimate that we could to be consistent with other programs, and we'll be reevaluating that for future fees.
Okay. Quickie, Dooley, we want to vote.
Well, I've been listening to the discussion, and I'm looking at the language on lines 12 through 16. And I would like to read an amendment. Whereas discussions with the New York State Department of Health concluded that the Finger Lakes Grassroots Festival should be regulated not as three campgrounds, but as a mass gathering in 2014. And the fee established should be consistent with the 20% average cost recovery in other Environmental Health Division programs. Is that the correct conclusion?
It certainly is on the first one. The 20%, it varies a lot, and that's just kind of a rough estimate. So
it's an average? approximate?
Yeah, approximation, I guess, is
anyway, it seemed that the important point was that it's changing from being campgrounds, three campgrounds, to mass gathering, and that's not in the resolution. So I would like to make that amendment.
I have a motion for that amendment. Is it friendly, first of all, Peter?
No.
Is there a second for the amendment? Carol Chalk. Discussion on the amendment. Ready to vote on the amendment?
Wait, can
Carol?
Is that in fact a change that was made in the rationale for the change? I'm not sure whether I want Liz or Julie to answer this, maybe both.
The addition about the three campgrounds is correct. I mean, that is what we used to regulate them as three campgrounds, and we're now doing it as a mass gathering. So but that's a clarification. That is correct.
But the second part is not fully explanatory.
So the idea that the fee is excessive, it doesn't seem to me to help the resolution a lot. It just, you want to say something that says you're being consistent with what the state is State Department of Health is recommending, and that you recover appropriate fees, something much more general than what's here. I think that's what I was trying to get at.
It sounds to me as if the first part was offered, there might be a different response in terms of whether it was friendly or not. I don't know.
Can I just ask that it get repeated, what it is you're offering?
Let's do one at a time here. We're talking about an amendment that Dooley has put forward that was not friendly. We've had a couple of questions on it. So who wants to speak on this again now? I've got Jim Dennis, then Martha.
I am calling the question, and that's it. I'm calling.
The question has been called on the amendment. Is there a second? Seconded by Brian Robison.
Can you read the amendment?
Julie, would you restate the amendment, please?
In lines 12 and 13. should be regulated not as three campgrounds, but as a mass gathering in 2014.
But that wasn't the whole thing, was it?
That's as much as I have now that I'm giving.
Okay. That's the amendment that you have proposed, just that part.
That's right.
Okay. Everyone clear on that? Yes. All right. All those in favor of calling the question, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Those opposed? Eleven to three. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see the third vote here. Okay, we will call the question on the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. Those opposed? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 opposed and 7 in favor. I guess we have a tie. Let's vote again. All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Those opposed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It fails. So we're back to the main motion.
Who's not voting?
I think it was 7-7. I think I counted 7 in favor.
Anyway, it fails anyway.
Still fails.
7-7.
All right, back to the main motion. Anyone else want to speak? Peter?
Call the question.
Question has been called on the main motion. There's a second by Brian Robison. All those that wish to call the question, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Those opposed? We have 2 opposed. On the resolution as originally presented, all those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. Thank you, Liz.
I ask that the minutes reflect my attempt to clarify the specifics of that resolution.
Okay. I believe Christina Dravis is here for Resolution D. Is that correct? And let's see. That's the one that was pulled. So it's Public Safety Committee. Brian?
Yes. Thank you. I'd like to bring forward Resolution D, ID 4650, creation of position, professional development coordinator, Department of Emergency Response. And I would move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Peter Stein. Who pulled that? Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I pulled it because I'm going to vote against it. And we had a pretty good discussion at the Budget Committee meeting. I think it was at Budget. And at the time, I think I voted yes just to get it through committee. I've got some concerns about the process. For me, when a position is created, it doesn't necessarily have to morph through two or three different descriptions, especially when it's understood that the person occupying the proposed job might have too much input into the actual description of the position. If I thought there was a way of making this more fair so that the public would have a chance so that you could put out a real, opportunity for the public to fairly apply, I would be more confident in this. As it is, it feels to me as though someone was hired and the description under which, or the idea under which they were hired was more vague than this. The money that was appropriated was for a different description than this. And now it feels as though to me the description has changed, and I was advised that the description changed with the advice of the incumbent, or the incumbent on the previous description that is not this one. For me, there's a little concern there if somebody gets to write their own job description. And if I misunderstood, that's great. But I also think that if somebody gets a chance to have a whole lot of input into a job description that they're applying for, it's an odd way to run government. And I also, as a legislator, when I agreed to the funding for this, had a different idea as to what this job would be than what it is coming out to be now. And I think we should have a discussion about that. I don't think I'm going to prevail at this, but for myself, I just needed to vote no in good conscience. It doesn't seem to me like open good government. So I apologize for any inconsistency I may have revealed or misunderstandings here, but I hope everybody will just accept my no vote in the spirit with which it's intended.
I'm going to go to Joe Mariana, County Administrator.
Yeah, I think I may have mumbled in the explanation of this position during committee. This is not a filled position. So I think this may be confused with the Communication Center Manager, which is filled by Christina Dravis. This is a vacant position. It's a brand new position that was created as a part of the 2014 budget by the legislature, so that we could focus on quality assurance and training within the 911 center. And at that time, we called it something else. And I can't remember what the title was, but it was basically quality assurance and training. And so what has happened since the arrival of Christina in the communication center manager position, in consultation with other people at the 911 center, they really looked at the way the job was kind of conceived and formulated to begin with, and they've come up with a title that is more reflective of what is expected of the position and a job description that is very clear. And again, I just want to make sure it's understood. And again, I briefed the committee on this, so it was probably in the telling. It's not filled. It is a vacant position. It is wide open to anybody who can meet the minimum calls. At some point, even though it's filled provisionally, the individual will have to take a civil service test to be able to hang on to the job. But again, the reason it was created is to fill a long-standing void in having the capacity to do careful quality assurance and ongoing training of the 911 staff. So that's what this is.
Can I just ask a couple of questions? I asked these at committee. It seems to me that there's, 25 people that would be covered by this?
Give or take. The total employment within the 911 center?
Christina's a...
Oh,
we have 21 dispatchers and supervisors currently.
Yeah. Okay. Christina, do you want to add anything?
The change in the job title, I did a lot of research when I got here, so I contacted Florida, California, Washington State, some really, really good centers out there to see what they had as far as like a training coordinator and a quality assurance person. So a lot of them are actually kind of going this direction because quality assurance is a really hot topic right now. So I actually kind of borrow this job description and job title from a couple of those other agencies too. But it is going to encompass the training program, the quality assurance, and the accreditation for the dispatchers.
Brian Robinson.
Thanks. Let's try to step back for just a second. A couple of years ago, we put forth money for a consultant to come in and do a top-to-bottom assessment of the 911 center. And this was the quality assurance piece and dedicating somebody to that was the most important part of the consultant's report that came back. We hadn't had one. As we all know, we'd been having complaints from different departments, the different end users, let's say, of the 911 center. They complained often. And it had to do mostly with quality assurance. As we decided, in the meantime, we had to get a new center manager, and thankfully we ended up with Christina. We had the funding for this position last year, but we decided not to fill it so that Christina could have input of the job. And the job description, and therein came the change of the title, as she just described. We had never heard it ourselves, but the function remained the same. And the last part I want to make, or point I want to make, is that as we were trying to find a dispatch center manager, we decided that as long as we were doing it, let's change the culture all the way, and that's where the accreditation piece fit in. So that's now part of this position as well. This position is, as Joe said, is new. It's never been filled. It's not promised to anyone. I would have no idea even where to look for somebody, and it does fall under civil service.
Have Peter Stein, then Carol Chalk, and then can we vote?
Yeah, very quickly, Kathy. I was listening to what you said, and you seemed concerned by the fact that Christina was involved in rewriting this job description. But I think to the contrary, it's very important that she did. That is to say, the sequence of events is that we decided before the her position was filled, we decided to put this slot in also as something that would help the director make sure of the quality of the services provided by the 911 center. And so, I mean, we're asking a lot of Christina, namely it's her center and that she's responsible for making it work. And as a result, it's very important that she have been involved in that, from my point of view, it's very important that she should have been involved in writing the job description for this position.
Carol?
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to what Peter just said. I know that this is an area that's been in need of some attention for quite some time, certainly as a representative from the city, which was one of the entities that pays us extra for the service.
You know, we've been hearing that there was a need for better training and better quality assurance. And if we've had somebody come in with some knowledge that we didn't have and who's been able to take the initiative to say that here's more that was needed, I'm willing to support it.
Leslin?
Yes, thank you. Joe, I was just a tiny bit confused in what you said earlier. You said this position is wide open. This is new, as far as I know.
Correct.
But somewhere in that, also you said the incumbent in this position would have to.
So if you fill it now, so right now there hasn't been a civil service test given.
Right.
So we can hire provisionally.
Thank you.
That's probably what we would do. But then ultimately that person has to pass a test and finish in the top three to be able to keep that job.
Okay.
That's what I meant.
So we'll have this position. We can hire somebody now to feel that there's no one sitting in this position
exactly.
Right now.
Right.
Thank you.
Let's proceed to a vote. This is on Resolution D, creation of position, Professional Development Coordinator, Department of Emergency Response. All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed? We have two opposed.
Mr. Chair, may I ask just a quick follow-up?
Sure.
So, Joe, there's going to be advertising for this position and recruitment.
Yes, we will post it as we do all.
Fill it provisionally.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
I think we should go take our break now. It's 7:28, so let's be back in our seats by 20 minutes of 8, and let's start at the top of the committee agenda and go through those.
Two sets, one for me and one for her.
Okay, folks, can we start?
It's called Brimmer.
Oh, yeah. Let's go to the standing committees and their reports. Now, Leslin, you're up first. Leslin, you're up first, or you can pass.
I've got a whining child here. I don't want to leave.
Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslin McBean, Claiborne, chair.
Joe said everything I was going to say, honestly.
No,
so,
well.
We are, today even better, we are moving along with so many things, and we're very, very thankful for all the work that's being done based on the policy. We will be looking to put together a small committee, just really, really small, to review as we get the responses to the RFP for the climate survey, to sort of review those and select someone or a company or group to do this. We decided to go with the RFP this round so that we have a process that's a bit more professional. We did it the first time. We thought we did a very good job with it. But there are people who specialize in doing this kind of work and will work with us to make sure that whatever it is that they put out there in terms of questions will suit our needs in the county. So that's where we're moving towards as we work on this. And that's my report.
Thank you. Short and to the point. Any questions for Leslin? Okay, let's move on to Health and Human Services Committee. Peter Stein, chair.
Yeah, well, we have, I guess we did the second of the two.
Correct.
I'd like to move Resolution E, 4639, appropriation from the Contingent Fund Terminal Pay Reimbursement for 2013, Mental Health Department.
Seconded by Kathy. This, I think, requires a short form roll call.
Discussion.
Is there any discussion? Go ahead.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Ms. Herrera?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That's unanimous. Thank you, Peter. Do you have any report?
No report. We haven't met since our last legislature meeting.
Any questions for Peter?
Our next meeting will be, when is it? The 10th, is it? Of?
Oh, let's
March,
see.
March 11th.
Sorry, I should have had this. Huh? The 11th at the usual time in the usual place.
Thank you. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Kathy Luz Herrera, chair.
Thank you. I have no report. Our next meeting will be in the legislative chambers at 10:30 on March 17th, and you don't have to wear green to be admitted.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Questions for Kathy. Economic Development Committee, Will Burbank, Chair.
Thank you, Mike. Well, the Economic Development Committee met yesterday, and we heard a report from Tom Knight on the progress of the 2020 Strategic Tourism Implementation Plan, which hopefully you have all read. It exists in spiral-bound copy. It looks like this, but it's also on the county's website. If you go to planning and then go to tourism under there, it's a really nice link. Read it sometime. It really, really brings alive you know, what the ideas are in terms of how to promote tourism and make it, you know, continue to have it a strong part of our local economy. As part of that, they have a series of funded projects that are you know, going to be doing. Carol mentioned one of them, which is the Farm to Table initiative. You all got this out there. There are visitor amenities in the soon-to-be-rebuilt commons. And the final thing is a series of wayfinding measures, which is a term that not everybody might be familiar with. It's basically figuring out how to use signage and other vehicles so that when new people come to our community, they can get around and easily get to the important things that we have to offer. And there's going to be this coming Tuesday a public meeting on the interpretive sign plan. It's going to be Tuesday, March 11th at 6:30 to 8 at the Tompkins County Library. And so that's on wayfinding. There are also several actions that the strategic tourism plan, Strategic Tourism Plan Board, STPB, will be doing in the coming year that Tom told us about. One is that they would really like to take a hard look at the experience of the Finger Lakes Wine Center and figure out why that didn't work and see if there's some lessons learned. I mean, a lot of effort was put into that and spent a lot of money, community resources, and see what we can learn from that. They're going to be convening a working group to promote ag and culinary tourism as sort of a niche kind of thing in our mix, and a similar group to do to look into what can be done to do heritage tourism. We have in our community a lot of things that speak to our history. You know, famous people have lived here. You could do like a whole literary tour of Ithacans, people who lived in Ithaca and wrote from Ithaca, and you know, will people come to visit Ithaca, and some portion of it might be interested in learning about the local heritage. So that was Tom's report. We also heard a report from Bruce Stoff, who's the director of the Convention Business Bureau, and he gave us an update on the hotel business over the past year. Last year was pretty strong. Year-over-year demand increased by 1.6%, and the daily rate increased by 3.8% to $144 on average. That's the good news. I mean, we actually are, you know, when you rent a hotel, we take in a lot of money. The bad news is that that's discouraging some people from renting hotels because we are one of the most expensive places to get a room in New York State. And occupancy has declined slightly, but enough that it was felt. It was down by 1.3%. We also heard a discussion of a phenomena that we mentioned 6-8 months ago, which is the growth of the Airbnb and related kind of alternatives where people are essentially not staying at local motels or hotels but are going online and renting rooms and homes. And that is starting to be a significant not huge, but a significant force in our community. And we are not collecting room tax on that. So that is a potential problem down the future. Short term, we've decided to try to be informative, make people aware that if they're doing this with regularity, they should be complying with local laws that relate to their municipality and also paying the room tax, or collecting the room tax, rather. The estimates that the CVB have done is that there's probably between $1.25 to $1.5 million worth of business from online rentals happening per year. And that's a lost revenues of about between $37,000 and $45,000. And finally, we heard a very good and interesting presentation from Mr. Ewan Barr, who's the consultant that's come to speak with what we can do to keep our airport strong. And he gave a presentation that was similar to the one that he gave at GEO. I invited him because there was only a little bit overlap the two of the committees, and I think we should all be trying to understand the very, very complex problem that we're facing. And I'm not going to go into detail. I assume at some point we'll have a greater discussion, but it was a very good discussion. Our next meeting will be on Monday, April 7th, and we continue to meet over in the old jail. Are there any questions?
Dan Klein.
Did I hear that correctly, that the occupancy rate went down?
Correct.
1.3%?
Yes.
Was there any discussion about the huge increase in the number of hotel rooms in the county at the same time that the rate is going down? Or
there's concern. Going down? Yeah, and we don't control that, of course. Sure. But and that what we're beginning to see is several of our hotels actually are getting old and kind of worn and have not been upgraded, and I think there's a sense that maybe we may eventually see one of those hotels cease to exist, or else they'll choose to redo that. One of the problems that we have in Ithaca is we tend to be completely full during the weekends, and midweek is where we have huge numbers of rooms available. And one of the things that we really need in this community is the ability to draw in midweek conferences. And we don't have the capacity currently in a hotel to do that. And so that's part of what people are hoping to move toward with the downtown Hotel Ithaca project.
Thank you.
Okay, I have folks that want to ask questions. Leslin first, then Martha, Nathan, and Peter.
Well, I have two or perhaps three questions. The first one, how different are Airbnbs, and I don't know much about them, from the folks who would rent their houses for graduation season or summer or that sort of stuff? And is that something we're looking into as well, or should be recommended that people look to as well? I know it's not as regular as throughout the year, in all fairness, maybe that should be looked at. And my other question is, it's troubling to me that I can find a hotel room in New York City cheaper than I can find here in Ithaca. And I hear what you say. Is that something the STPB is looking into? And is there anything that can be done about that?
I'll take the second one first. Once again, the hotels set their own rates, Bruce is trying to get the local innkeepers to address and see if they can't collectively take a look at that. Because back to your first question, which was, does this apply to everything? Anything more than three nights essentially is considered, or four nights is considered a taxable event. So if you are just doing it for, one or two nights in graduation, we would probably not consider that to be part of that, treated that way. Not we, but that's what we've been told.
I understand.
Yeah.
But I hope it's something that we'll look at, because I know there are people who rent their houses for more than one or two nights.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Graduation week or summer or whatever.
Yeah. Martha?
Yeah, I think the definition is has to do with, Joe, am I right? The finance director kind of sets that definition, because he's the one who administers the room tax. So I guess under David, it was identified as four consecutive nights, and that like once a year with those nights. Dan, so as to price, yeah, we've got hotels sort of in the pipeline to be built, and some that have been built, but the supply is really what's going to determine the price. So if we're concerned about prices being too high, then it's a good thing that the industry is responding by building more rooms. On the other hand, if you're worried about vacancy, then you're worried. It seems like from the report, it seems like there were some anomalies that the Trip Hotel, formerly the Clarion, for the last, 3 months, like, wasn't reporting anything. So if you take that number of rooms out of the system, out of the calculations, suddenly that's like 0.5% right there. You have to look at the weather this winter. You know, everything's kind of down. So they're watching it, obviously, but, wasn't like, oh, my God, maybe we shouldn't be building these hotels. In a sense, actually, we want to increase, especially the midweek traffic, which is what the Hotel Ithaca, it's formerly Holiday Inn, conference center is all about. So it's a matter of building the right kind of space to support the midweek visitors.
Nate?
Yeah, to add to that, I mean, I think there's a perception issue too. I mean, all it takes is one visit to hotels.com for you to say, wow, it's really expensive in Ithaca. I'm not looking at hotels. And then just to go to Airbnb and find a place for $60 a night. And so I would assume that would affect occupancy, especially when you're talking $1.5 million of it going to Airbnb.
Yep. Peter?
Well, a couple of things. I'm not sure why we should be concerned about vacancy rate. I think we ought to be concerned about the number of people that are sleeping here, but not whether the hotel is making money. I mean, that's the old, good old capitalist system. They stop making money, then they'll stop building new motels. And I don't know. So the other thing that I'm wondering about is, I happen to like B&Bs, and I like to stay at B&Bs. But every B&B that I stay at, they pay taxes. When you get the bill, it has their amount plus the tax. So is there a systematic way by which that somebody enforces that or not? Sounded like from what you were saying, there isn't. That it's, or did I miss something?
May I answer?
Sure.
So Peter, there are people. There are businesses that sort of are organized as B&Bs, which is if you went to a website, say, look, Google B&Bs, you might find people that, I mean, they do this every day. That's what they're in business for. But what we're describing, and I use the term Airbnb, which is a proprietary term, but there are actually a number of online services that allow people who are not in the normal business but just want to from time to time. The people that are in full-time business, they're paying the tax. And they too, have been coming to us to say, hey, we are at a competitive disadvantage because this is something we're having to charge and these other folks are not.
Okay, thank you.
Have Kathy, Jim, Carol, then I'd like to vote.
Thank you. I really appreciate this report and the fact that you're willing to touch on this. It's an issue, but I think it's one we can embrace. In Fall Creek, excuse me, on our listserv, not a week goes by that we don't have someone advertising that they're going to be out of town and would someone like to rent their place for a few days or while they're gone. And I know that some of my neighbors utilize Airbnb and others to make money to help pay our tax our tax bills. And in Fall Creek, as you all know, they're exceptionally high. I think we need to find a way to embrace it, because there's a lot of people for whom travel is a social experience. It's an experience, and they don't necessarily want to stay at a hotel. They want to have somebody that knows the area that can say, you know, this restaurant's overpriced, but this one has really good food. And there's a way that this is actually helping our economy. Yeah, we may lose $30,000 or $40,000 in tax revenues, but there's also other increased revenues that we get. Now, I understand that there's a legitimate concern that the folks that are part of the STPB are feeling that they're underwriting, you know, they're paying more and they're at a competitive disadvantage. And I think that there's a way that conversations need to be had. I also want to say that people know that, excuse me, hotels and restaurants pay not very well. At least most of their employees don't get paid very well. And for some people, it's a conscious decision to go direct, to cut out the middleman and to go directly to someone that lives in the town that you're trying to visit and to go stay with them. And sometimes friendships and such are made. This isn't going to go away. This is something, especially that a lot of younger people, it's the way they like to travel. So I think we need to find a way to embrace this instead of seeing it as usurping some territory. When Dan asked the question about occupancy, I had thought to myself, and other people in their comments, I think, also touched on this, that we can't necessarily assume that there's a causal relationship because there's so many other factors. And, in fact, the drop in hotel occupancy rate might be due to there being more hotel rooms. It might be due to a blip in the system. I think that there's a way that the STPB could embrace this and try and figure out a way to utilize their resources along with the resources of people that are bringing people to this community who are going to be tourists. They're going to spend money here. They're going to come back. Everybody knows that once you've been here, especially if you have a good time, you're going to come back. So I just want to say let's continue this discussion, but maybe not with such an adversarial tone, because I don't think it has to be one or the other, and I don't think there's any way to really stop it from happening.
I'm sorry if I imparted an adversarial tone. That is certainly not has been the approach from the outreach. Essentially, I mean, we also have, you know, several million dollars worth of wonderful community programs and resources that are being supported by these taxes. And one of the reasons people like coming here is for the festivals and the things that exist because they're paying a little chunk. So, but at this point, the approach is try to say, hey, if you're doing this regularly, this is the tax. Please participate. And that's.
And I do know some folks that have Airbnb that do pay the tax because they do it pretty often,
yeah.
And they're willing. So, you know, we can do this. Let's pull it together.
Forget what I said about voting since we're only on a committee report, by the way. Kathy Covert reminded me of that. I have Jim, Carol, then Martha. Then can we conclude?
Michael, I will pass. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Jim, did you pass?
Yes, I did.
Thank you. Carol?
Yeah, I just want to reinforce the sense that I've heard several of these discussions now at the STPB from Bruce Stoff and the CVB and then at the committee. And in all of them, there seemed to be a really interesting, lively discussion, but good attitude about what I would consider a positive attitude rather than adversarial about how do we build this in, how do we acknowledge that this is a changing world in terms of how people get their information, how do we make sure that people who are doing the renting of their homes, and apparently pretty much everybody who's been approached, they have found ways to look at those who have higher activity or approaching them first, and that they have for the most part said, oh, I didn't know about this, and I'm happy to pay it, recognizing that one of the reasons that the hotel keepers and innkeepers, B&Bs, agreed to participate in the room tax program, which they weren't enthusiastic about years and years ago, predates my time, but have found it to be very positive, is in the ways in which they are jointly marketed. And so once you're paying that tax, it does raise issues of, well, then you should be entitled to be marketed as well. We have many, many weekends here where you can't get a hotel room, which is one of the reasons people are going to Airbnb and other such sites. But that's complicated, too, because with hotels there are certain standards and zoning requirements and health requirements and things that are being maintained. So how do we go about helping to market them if we don't know the quality? So there's all kinds of good questions, but what I was impressed with uniformly across all of these discussions was the spirit of cooperation and not, we better just rule these out. It was a real spirit of, these are just things we're grappling with, and as a program, they're doing a great job.
Martha, and let's move on.
I'll just say one last thing, which is just to make it clear that the heads in beds was not the number that went down. It was the occupancy rate. There are more beds. So there was the rate lowered, but in fact the heads or whatever parts of the body you want to put in those beds were
okay.
Still increasing.
Thanks.
Just two more things. One is that I guess whether it's the CVB or the finance department is reaching out to these frequent users and encouraging them to register. And if they register, so if they agree to pay the tax and they register, then they go on the finance department website or the CVB website so that they will be part of the joint marketing. So it's not just pay the tax or else. It's like you pay the tax, you become part of this larger marketing program. And so there's something in it for the renter. The numbers that this Ithaca College student crunched and found as far as what's the volume here, the equivalent of a 50-bed hotel every night of the week. So it's meaningful, and why should we care if the hotels go empty and don't succeed? I think we, like any infrastructure in our community, it's not like a positive thing if people are struggling, if their businesses are struggling, whether it's a hotel or a restaurant or whatever. So it's just something that it's good that we're watching it. I think it's good that we have the carrot as opposed to the stick approach.
Okay, Will?
That concludes my report. I apologize for the length. I would note that I normally don't go this long. So.
It was a good report. You had a lot of good things to talk about. Can we move on to government operations? Nathan Shinagawa, Chair.
Yes, the Government Operations Committee met last Tuesday. We spent most of the meeting actually talking about the airport. We had two presentations, one from Ewan Barr, which, as Will said, was very interesting and definitely worth a legislature hearing. A few points for me that I thought were fascinating was, the main one is just that how much higher we charge the airlines compared to other airports in the area. I mean, it is significantly high. I think the average is $8 for most regional airports like ours, and we charge $11, and we are compared to the hospitals in this region. Oh, we do 13. Oh, sorry, we charge 13. And compared to Binghamton and Elmira and other local airports, we are multiples higher than they are. So that was actually really fascinating to learn. He obviously had a lot to talk about. Clearly, he's somebody that's very well connected to the industry, and he's also very receptive. I had a number of concerns about customer service, and he immediately followed up with those by looking at the Department of Transportation, looking at complaints that were filed with the airport on my behalf, and found that there weren't these significant complaints with our airport. Obviously, there are complaints with the airlines, but not necessarily about the airport, which I think then, for me, shows that there's still opportunity in taking good experiences to great experiences to build a sense of customer loyalty. But anyway, it was a very good presentation. We also had a presentation about the... I guess you could say the expansion of the terminal and other spaces at the airport. Basically, there is Bob Nicholas has worked with it's Labella. Was he working with it's not CNS. Sorry, it's CNS. Gosh, CNS, and they are proposing a I think it's a 5.6 $5.6 million project. Is that right?
$5.8
million project, which would do a number of things. It would expand the space in the terminal and in the dining areas, move the community room, and more importantly, though, it would add ticketing office space. Currently, United uses modulars and doesn't have a space off of the ticket counters, and so we're not able to maximize the revenue in which we can get from them. And then also what's happening is that the TSA uses a large amount of ticket counter space, and with the new machine that's going to be coming in that's going to scan bags at a considerably higher rate than it takes TSA officers to sort through bags manually, that machine actually has to be placed out in front of the ticket booths. Which will be an eyesore, but also will mess with the flow of the area as well. So this this project would help do all those things that I mentioned, but also the project, I think about almost maybe a third to a half of it, it has to do with upgrades to mechanical spaces, like new air handler systems, which haven't been updated since the inception of the airport or the creation of this current airport as we know it, new electrical wiring and plumbing. And so it will be an upgrade to the airport. Now, the cost of this can actually be paid for by the retirement of debt from the original project that should be retiring in, 2017 or 18 or something like that, right? And so I'm sure I'm doing a lot of this off the top of my head, so I'm trying my best. So that was just a presentation that Bob had. That we don't have a resolution or anything in front of us immediately. And so then we went over our resolutions. And at our next Government Operations Committee meeting, we are going to do a number of things. But I think a big discussion that we're going to have is regarding rules on public comment. And so Mike Lane has asked that that the Government Operations Committee look at this in greater depth and detail. And so we will do that. We've actually invited Mike to join the meeting since he is the one that runs the legislature meetings. We've also asked Sheriff Lansing to come to the meeting as well to provide some of his insight on this issue. And so that next meeting is not for a few weeks.
Nathan, one thing on the... on the bond payments for this proposed project,
oh, yeah,
the airport,
yes.
Could you mention where the money comes from?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, there's a fee right now that is per passenger. It's,
I think it's $4.50.
$4.50, which hasn't been increased in several years. And so actually Bob is saying that there's a chance that in the next couple of years it will be moved up to where they think around a $7 to $8 range. But anyway, that's paid for by the – it's a passenger fee.
Passenger facility charge. And that rate is established by the federal government. That's not locally controlled. That's standard across the country.
Yeah. And right now, Bob has enough money that's been generated by that fee to actually do the study and the plans for this project.
Questions? I have Martha, then Will.
I'm stunned. This is the first I've heard of this, of an airport expansion project. We just heard, and at ED, about how expensive our cost per passenger is. What is Bob doing talking about finding a way to use, you know, in a few years when we can retire that debt and immediately drop the per passenger cost by $4.50? What is he's...
Yeah, but that's a separate cost than what we're charging the airlines.
But doesn't it all add?
No. This would be levied. This charge would be levied regardless. So this
it's
is a standard national per passenger fee, and the intent of that fee is to do the kind of projects that we're talking about. So it's a facilities charge. In fact, one of the reasons that Bob and the engineers have worked so hard on this is to get things like the mechanical system built into a larger package of improvements, so that we can finance that basic work with the PFC as opposed to other dollars. So again, it's using that $4.50 to carry the cost of an improvement. I think when you look at it, as Nathan has said, much of it is in the mechanicals, much of it is in the security side of the airport to accommodate the TSA. And while that is going on, it's not a huge expansion of the facility. There's a little bit of room added for basically customer comfort and convenience. So, again, I think what Bob wanted to do at F&I was to just basically broach this, get it out there, get into the conversation. Nothing is happening to allocate money or anything like that. It still will have to go through committee review for first the design, and then after the design comes back, the authorization of the full project. So this is a long lead item.
Okay. I understand, and I understand that I'm not questioning whether those improvements would be beneficial. It still feels like kind of concentrating on completely the wrong thing. So are you saying that this facilities fee is tacked on to every ticket and it's a pass-through, so the airline's not paying it out of their – it's not like the landing fees that they pay?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, it's like part of your ticket price that everybody pays regardless of whatever airport that you're going to be going to.
But if you – but you also said – you mentioned – the debt that's going to be – that will be retiring in a few years?
Yeah. So that money, Martha, right, if we don't spend it, it just goes into an account, all right? And that account can be used for different things at the airport, but it's very limited, which is why it's accumulated, because some things have retired, that it's accumulated the sum that it has been able to accumulate so far to pay for this study.
So some of the money now goes to cover debt service on the original terminal project, not all of it. So the rest of it is going into this account, being held basically in reserve for future projects. So come 2017, 2018, the debt service will be retired. That will liberate that portion of the PFC, and it can then be allocated for other future improvements.
Right, but, these are for capital improvements. I mean, you can't use that money to lower the fee for the airlines or anything like that.
Will.
Change the topic. The other thing you mentioned was that you'll be looking, considering our approach to having speakers.
Yeah.
And am I right, Nate, that you'll be maybe having a broader discussion in terms of when people come into this chamber and maybe behave in ways that are problematic beyond just speaking, part of that thinking?
That is correct. We are going to look at a number of things, and that's why we have the sheriff coming too. Everything from the public comment to the behavior of folks and how to and one of the things that's been suggested is figuring out different levels of response based on the situation that is before us.
Thank you. And I mean, the one other little piece of that might be what is appropriate use of signage within the space, if we want to have any limits on that. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That's not wayfinding.
No, it is not.
Can we move on to Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee? Carol Chalk, Chair.
Yes. The committee met on February 19th. We then met briefly again before a special meeting right before this that I'll talk about in a few minutes. On the 19th, primarily what we did was go over the work plan of the County Planning Department in great detail. And, boy, anybody who has any questions about what do those folks do over there with all of with their time and their staff, I encourage you to go and look through the packet from that meeting on the 19th and their detailed work plan. They must have gone through, don't quote me on the number because I don't have it here, but 87 specific objectives, strategies, actions, grants that they're administering, have running the gamut from land policy and land conservation to stream corridor protection and aquifers, agricultural development rights, housing in a multitude of ways, GIS, everything from trails to snowmobiles, you name it. And the volume of very specific activities that they engage in was interesting and served, because we're a pretty new committee. We've got three new members who've never been on planning before, I think, served as a good orientation, I think. We also heard a similar, a pretty detailed report about our housing fund our housing program, which consists of those two funds, which are the Housing Affordability Fund and the Housing Trust Fund, and as part of the housing discussion, talked about the need to be looking more closely. It wasn't specifically in this year's work plan, so it would have to be, we'd have to talk about how to do it, but to get more of a handle on what is the status of our housing. The last time we looked at it in great detail was in 2006. What are the number of units? What kind of prices? What's the market for more of them? How many of them are affordable? So the need to do more of that. And there are some, there is some information out there, and it might make sense as we find the resources to that may already be out there, having looked at that, to Mike, to do something here at the legislature rather than have it come only to the committee. So that was very interesting. And then the rest was sort of internal committee work, liaisons and goals for the committee. And then in addition to that, we had a longer conversation about the resolution that's going to come to you tonight. Was originally one long resolution on the energy plan, New York State, every number of years, takes a look at the energy mix. And it's normally not a big deal. And this year's 2014 New York State Energy Plan is becoming a bigger deal because of energy discussions and because New York turned it into a bigger deal. It's a 600-page tome, and people like Ed Marks and Katie Borghella from our planning department had looked at it and had some comments. Other people have looked at it. And so what we brought to the committee was a lengthier resolution with lots of whereases and resolveds. And what the committee decided to do was that we agreed with the tenor of that, but that it was a little bit confusing to talk about the positives and the negatives. So they asked Ed Marks to rewrite a simpler resolution, and then he and I to go through all of the detail that had been in the resolution that came to committee and come back to a special meeting that we had tonight with that listing. And so what came out of committee tonight, just before this, was the revised version, the suggested revisions from legislators Kiefer and Chalk. Shall I move it or talk about it? How do you want me to?
That was passed by the committee.
That was the revised version of the committee. So I will pass the committee the one that was passed by committee, and assuming
folders.
It's seconded, I will talk about it just for a few minutes.
Been moved. Is there a second? Seconded by Dave McKenna.
Do I need to read the title? It's Resolution H, Suggested Revisions from Legislators Kiefer and Chop, providing comments and recommending important revisions to the 2014 draft New York State Energy Plan. So moved.
Discussion. Yes, go ahead.
So, basically, overall, the positives in the plan, and you'll see them in the listing, primarily is that New York State, after having a draft version of this for many years but never actually adopting it, is actually setting emissions goals. These numbers of 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and 80% by 2050 is considered by many to be a real landmark and a positive step. They have some initiatives in the plan that we wanted to reinforce. The planners on our staff looked at this and said, boy, the goal is good. There are some major initiatives listed, but it isn't really a plan in that it doesn't set specific targets and specific ways in which we'll know whether we're meeting that plan along the way. We'll just get to 2050 and we'll have met it or not. And that runs very counter to what New York State asks us to do, or our planning department to do, every time they apply for a grant proposal, most specifically the Southern Tier Regional Economic Planning Board, that Cleaner Greener grant. It was required to have very specific targets along the way. So that was a major element. The changes that were in here suggested by Dooley primarily, but I typed them up because she didn't have access to a computer at the moment, basically took, I had five different divisions that when the committee asked me to headline things, she just was recommending four, that we didn't need crucial revisions and some revisions. I took what Dooley had suggested, an extra whereas, but the committee had said we wanted to keep the resolution simpler the way Ed had it, so I took all of the wording in your suggested whereas, Dooley, and put it into that listing, so all of the wording is there. And then other than that, we sort of just consolidated some bullet points and kept most of the essence. So it's pretty much what you read in your packet.
Are we ready to vote, or do we need to talk about it? Good. Let's vote. All those in favor of the I'm sorry?
I want to debate.
You want to talk about it? All right. Peter Stein.
Well, I like this. I read it. Unfortunately, there is something that will cause me to vote against it, and I don't want to do that. And that is three lines on page 4 of the revised form. Line 25 and 26, and I would like to move that we delete those, and one other word to make it make sense, the word instead on line 27. Essentially, that's my motion, so if there's a second, I'll talk
so
about
it. So we have an amendment that's been moved by Peter to delete lines 25 and 6 on page 4, seconded by Mike Sigler.
Okay.
On the amendment, Peter.
Yeah. The statement that those two lines make is that natural gas has no function in reducing global warming. It doesn't say that exactly, but that's the clear implication. And I believe that's not true. I believe that the consensus of pretty much everyone is that there is an important role for natural gas. It certainly is the position of the United States government and President Obama that, in fact, natural gas has an important role to play. And so I would just like to delete those particular words because otherwise I agree with it completely.
Carol?
Unless Mike, did you have your hand up first?
I'm sorry. Carol is next.
So we talked about this in committee, and gosh, Peter, we worked really hard both in committee and when we rewrote this to respond to the discussion that we've had here at the legislature. To what this resolution, nowhere in it does this include. Does this make any conclusions about the argument that we've had here about the relative contribution of methane versus carbon to greenhouse gas emissions? I was really careful to leave that out and to just merely say that they both do. And if you read it really carefully, what it is saying is that a plan to get us to a point where we're reducing emissions will use new money, new policy to get us there. It doesn't say remove gas that exists. It doesn't say make sure there's no gas anywhere. So nowhere in here does it say that, and I think we worked really hard to do that. And we did talk about this a little bit about at committee. I did bring up your concerns, and the consensus of the committee, and it actually came out unanimously at the time, was that we'd done a pretty good job of managing to not get into that exact argument. So I hoped that you would read it in that spirit, because it doesn't say gas is worse than coal. It doesn't say gas it should be taken out, all gas that we've got anywhere. It just says that when we invest in new things, it should be in these renewables. That if we're talking about a plan, it needs to talk about how to get us there. So I was hoping it was going to satisfy you, and I'm hoping you would withdraw your objection.
Mike, do you want to speak?
I do. Peter, your concern is the same as mine. I don't read it in quite the harsh light that you do, but that's why I seconded your thing, because I hope you leave it on the floor. I mean, I'd like to see a vote on that. Just because, I mean, if you see it that way, I think a lot of people will see it that way. I don't know. I mean, I would like it removed. I would have liked to see it removed at committee, but I do. I think this is like a pretty close to I would vote for this. I did vote for it. And it is. That line does hang me up, but I don't know. Overall, I think the document, you did really good job here. I mean, the wording is great. And like I said, I don't read that in quite the harsh light you do. I mean, I was looking at it more as the overall goal is here, and we really can't get there just with one thing. So, and the other thing that hangs me up is substantial. I don't know what that is. Substantial, by what does that mean? I mean, your idea of substantial build-out may be completely different than my idea of a substantial build-out. So I thought it was vague enough whereas I could probably vote for this. So, but I'd like to hear what other people have to say, frankly.
Peter's next.
Yeah, I'd just like to respond to what Carol said. There's nothing personal about this, and I think the statement is very clear. It says increasing New York State reliance on natural gas, blah, 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 will inhibit the changes for successful achievement of the overall goal, increasing it. And the strategy of the United States and the administration is that we must replace coal with natural gas. It doesn't say anything against renewables, but I think that the conclusion is that it's physically impossible to increase renewables as fast as you have to decrease coal. And so there is a goal. I agree with you, Carol. It'd be better to have renewables, but I believe that it is generally accepted in the world that there is a current role for natural gas, and that it has to be done quickly. We don't have a lot of time. So I've heard this time and time again. Unless we can convince China, for instance, to change from coal to natural gas, the whole battle is lost. And I feel sort of strongly about that. If it's true for China, it may be true of New York. I frankly don't know. I haven't looked at the numbers. Maybe renewables can be made much faster in China. It's obviously better to do it with renewables than natural gas. But if it isn't, then it may be possible that it will contribute to the problem by replacing coal with natural gas. And this sentence, English, clearly says that we must not do that. So that's the point.
This is not a new issue for this group, so I don't think we need to debate it all again. We're trying to vote on an amendment. I have Carol, then I have Martha, and I see Kathy's hand up. But then I'd like to see if we couldn't vote.
I just would prefer to keep it in here. If the only word that you had an objection to was substantial, I'd change it.
No, that wasn't.
No, it's not my objection.
Okay,
I think
Martha?
It was inhibit was the.
Yeah, I think the two bullets, the bullet above says Tompkins County, the home of Cornell University, is the home of state-of-the-art research. And then right above the increasing New York State reliance, okay, so lines 21, and the bullets starting with line 8 and line 21, lay out, I think, what the issue is. And I think if this is the policy of the state, what is the state of New York going to do with its resources? I don't think we should be supporting an increase in natural gas. If the industry wants to do it, and for whatever, if that's their business model, and I don't know. Obviously, regulation has a lot to do with what happens, but I think this is a very balanced set of statements. It's well written, well researched, and I think it's true. I think that if we, as a policy, decide we're going to increase gas, it's going to divert and delay the other efforts that are required for us to meet this goal.
Kathy, then let's vote.
Thank you. For me, the amendment as proposed, it jeopardizes my vote, and I believe that it jeopardizes more votes than it would encourage. I'm not going to vote for this amendment.
Can you pull up to your microphone?
Oh, yeah.
It's really hard to hear you.
Sure. This won't get my vote, and I think it would cost more votes than it gains. Just saying, I wouldn't vote for it, and I won't vote for the thing if you take this out.
Okay. On the amendment that Peter Stein has offered, which is on page 4 of the resolution to delete the bullet at lines 25 and 26. All those in favor of that amendment, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All those opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. The amendment fails. Now we're on the main motion. Can we proceed to a vote on it? Martha?
I just want to commend Carol. And did you draft it? And Ed and the committee for doing this kind of in-depth work. And I appreciate that you also had the move the timetable so that this can get out to other counties. And we hope simulate other conversations and similar comments from other municipalities. Thank you.
Okay, on the main motion, which is a revised version of Resolution H. All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Those opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4 opposed. That resolution passes. Thank you, Carol.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Charter Review Committee met on the 19th of February to begin our discussion about how to tackle the charter. And we also had to change our meeting date so that we can get all five of our members together. And we will be meeting tomorrow again because we've moved to the first Wednesday of the month. And we will start from page 1, and we will be going through it line by line. And as we come to various departments that are affected by the charter, we will be inviting in the members of the members of the legislature, I was going to say, no, our department heads and other employees who are affected by that. And that's pretty much what we've done on that committee. The old library committee, we've scheduled a meeting, I think, for what, the 24th?
No, the
week of the 25th, we're going to set one up. We aren't going to be taking any action. The REIFs, the request for expressions of interest, I made it. I used to confuse that one. Will be in approximately then. We won't be actually voting to move any forward or reviewing any of them. We'll just start that process. So some of you folks that have wondered about whether we needed a meeting prior to that, I think our first meeting in March will be doing the preliminary work.
Is that meeting set yet?
No, we haven't quite got it set.
Okay.
Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, James
Thank
Dennis,
you, Michael. We meet on March 24th at 4 p.m., and two of the resolutions that will be on there are the bond resolutions, one for the jail renovation and also the day reporting bond that will be used to fix the human service building to move day reporting out of the old library. And that concludes my report.
Jim, I wonder if you could please move Resolution I that was added to the agenda.
I will. Recommending an alternative to the two-year property tax freeze proposed in the 2014-15 executive budget that will lead to permanent and historic property tax reductions by eliminating the cost of state-mandated spending opposed on county property tax levy. And I would move that.
Seconded by Kathy Luz Herrera. Discussion. Dooley Kiefer.
I'm looking at packet page 2, the resolution page 2, the third whereas from the top. The third line, I think there's an extraneous word in there, the word that.
Say again where you're looking, please. Please.
It's the second page of the handout, the third whereas, the third line down. The word that, I think, is extraneous. I don't think you need that word.
I don't see. Oh, there it is.
Read. I don't.
Yeah, Dooley, we're looking at the one that was in our red folder. Are you looking at something different?
Not on an agenda. Legislator Dennis will introduce.
The second to last whereas.
Oh, I'm the wrong page. That's my problem.
Yes, thank you. Counting the other way. Next to the last whereas.
The third whereas on the second page. And you want to remove payers and this transfer. That contributes greatly?
No, just the word that, I think, is... doesn't belong there. That's all.
Is that friendly, Jim, to remove that?
Yeah, I don't see it, but yeah.
Kathy, is it friendly?
I see it. It makes sense.
I don't think it's on mine.
Mike Sigler.
Is debate open now?
I'm sorry?
Is debate open?
Absolutely.
I guess I agree with everything in this. I'm just wondering if maybe we shouldn't take a step back a little bit. Because it would seem to me, I really want this to happen. And it just seems to me the more you push somebody, the more recalcitrant they become. And I don't know if this is the particular time to be pushing the governor. I would like the governor to look at this and say, this is a great idea, and take ownership of it and make this his big campaign issue for this year. And it just would seem to me that the more counties pass this, you can say, yeah, all the counties are supporting it, but he's going to say, I don't know. I just, for some reason, this just seems to me a smarter move is to get the governor alone in a room with Joe Mariana and say, what do you think of this idea? I don't know. It just seems to me that is a wiser course. So I don't know. You guys can disagree with that. Like I said, I agree with this. I think the state should take over Medicaid. I think that's a great idea. The key is I'm not governor, and this, you know, Andrew is, and I would like to, for him to say it. So,
I've got a number of people want to speak, but before we go there, I just want to say that remember that we are on record as supporting this effort.
No, I understand.
Already. Peter Stein.
Still in an uncomfortable position. I walked into this room enthusiastically going to vote yes on it. And when I started to think about it, I think it needs more thought. And I'm trying to look at it from the point of view of someone who thinks that we ought to have property taxes not keep increasing in New York. Now, the problem I see is that we are only a quarter of the property tax in this particular county. And so how would this thing work? That they wouldn't have any, because of the fact that they would take over our expense for Medicaid, They wouldn't worry anymore about what the schools were doing and the towns and the cities in there. That doesn't sound right to me. That's one thing. And the other thing is that, now I'm not looking at it from my point of view, but I'm looking at it from a skeptic's point of view, like the governor, who thinks that all of the local governments are irresponsible, that if in fact they did that and they didn't have some kind of a cap, well, we could just eat that whole thing up for ourselves and not pass it on to the taxpayers. And it really wouldn't increase local tax. There's nothing in there that says that that we would have a tax cap, you know, a new tax cap, which wouldn't let us increase local spending. You understand what I'm saying?
Can we ask Joe Mariana to respond?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I can think of a couple of different avenues of response. The first is the governor's plan doesn't cut taxes. The governor's plan really tries to keep taxes where they are right now. If the goal is property tax relief, then what the governor has proposed really doesn't achieve property tax relief, and it creates a number of very adverse consequences at the local level. What we have proposed is a way for the state to achieve real property tax relief. If that's its primary goal, and if this is a reason the economy is not taking off, then let's deal with property taxes and let's cut them. And the way to do that is to shift, we think, mandates from us to them. Would this then ignore property tax constraint in other levels of government? No, there's still a cap. Still a cap. That's law. But this, as you know, this is an enticement to really kind of, I don't know, put a tighter lid on that cap. But it doesn't, again, let's say the state agreed to do this, to take over Medicaid. You know what the numbers are. This would be an immediate, almost $300 cut in property taxes for the average homeowner here. That's real property tax relief. In doing that, though, it doesn't eliminate property tax caps that are in place for every level of government in New York State. That still is a constraint that we will all live under, including all of these school districts and local governments in New York State. The state doesn't walk away from its cap. They simply take away this hammer that they propose to use to keep us within the cap and force consolidations.
Well, but how come we don't say in that we will, I mean, we're going to allow ourselves the freedom to not to use this money that we'll be saving. I mean, our budget will be reduced by this if they do that. And then our cap, they're not going to change the law and say that the cap won't apply to counties anymore. So our base point will be what it was before they took it away. So we could just keep increasing at random, not at random, but increasing property tax to come back to that point. And there's nothing in there that says something different than that. That's what bothers me, okay?
I think the unspoken is the expectation would be there'd be a reciprocal requirement on the part of the state that if we can save $11.8 million in Medicaid costs, that we would bring our levy down by $11.8 million.
I think it should say that in there. I think that's a very important part. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't think of that before, so I didn't write some kind of a statement that would say that.
Carol,
but it makes a much more powerful thing if we make that statement.
Carol Chalk.
Yeah,
then Martha, then Brian.
I'd sure like to see us pass this unanimously, because I think that when we heard Joe give his presentation, it was, you know, like the light went off. This is just a new way to hear the same old words we've been hearing. I mean, boy, I wish I could believe that our governor is reasonable enough that if we actually just sat, could even get an appointment to sit down in a room with him, that he'd see the light. Somehow, I'm not sure that I would trust that. I think that he's carved out his position and that what he responds to is the political pressure from across New York State, especially if it's in a bipartisan way, which I think would be really important. If anything, I was wondering if it Oh, so we saw the light when Joe gave his presentation, and I heard it all in a way that was more clear than I'd heard it before. And I think that we found the same thing at NYSAC, that that sort of the light went off in various rooms, and by the time we were talking to people from the state, they were using some of Joe's points, even though Joe hadn't given the presentation, had kind of circulated. So I think that this wording has found a way to speak to people that I think has been powerful. If anything, there was one item that I thought might not be strong enough, because one of the points that you made to me that you didn't say in these exact words, but I was looking for some wording that could add maybe to the first whereas at the top of the second page, or somewhere else, but making very crystal clear in one phrase that the only way to seriously cut taxes is that the entity responsible for the expenditures has to be the one in the position to levy the tax. Otherwise, there's no incentive to cut the programs. And you're saying that to us was one of the things that made the light go off for me, but I'm not sure exactly how to say that. The entity responsible for expenditures and delivery of a program should be directly accountable to those paying the tax burden, or it should be the same entity setting the tax burden. So I was thinking that wording like that, but I'd be prepared to pass it the way it is now, and I would hope that we could get to a point where this could be unanimously passed. What was the time frame? Was there a reason to do this now?
Well, the budget will pass, we think, by April 1st. Oh. So the clock is really ticking.
Remember, this was a request from our assemblywoman.
Yeah.
Here's what I have, and it's 10 minutes of 9, folks. I have Martha, Brian, Jim, Peter, and Mike. Can we just limit it to those and then vote?
No.
Martha?
I hear, Peter, maybe what you're talking about, if we take the second whereas on the second page.
I'm trying to put something together to make a resolution or an amendment.
On the floor, right?
Try to put this in.
Well, I was going to say that it might go in the second whereas on the second page.
It's not a whereas. It has to go as a resolved.
Okay. Oh, I'm not done. All right. I'd still like to say what I wanted to say, Peter. Thank you. That okay. I think that we might be able to say that. I mean, it's sort of the second whereas on the second page kind of says Tompkins County. If this shift happened, Tompkins County taxpayers would enjoy an immediate 20% reduction in county taxes. Now, if it's stronger to say something like Tompkins County government or the Tompkins County legislature, maybe this is why you're saying this goes in the resolved, would resolve to return that or to reduce our spending commensurately. So maybe that's what you're sort of, to make it even more explicit than it kind of is there. So I think that'd be fine. Mike, I don't think the governor is the audience for this at all. This is for the Assembly and the Senate so that they can resist the governor. They have to pass. He may hold a lot of cards, and he may be an aggressive advocate for, that's a polite way of saying something else, an aggressive advocate for things that he has decided. And he doesn't, everything I've watched in this guy, he doesn't change his mind. He's decided this is his thing. But he has to get the two houses to go along with him. So, listen, I was in a room with him in 2010. In August 2010, he was here at the Women's Community Building. And there's a photograph on my desk, and Carol's in it. Well, I'm literally doing this to Andrew Cuomo, and everybody else in the room was talking to him about fracking, and I'm saying, you can't, and he was a candidate, you can't advocate for a tax cap without taking over the mandates.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we know. That's, we're going to do that, too. They, you know, no, they weren't. It was a better bumper sticker to say, we're going to just cap your property taxes completely irresponsibly, knowing full well why county property taxes are so high in New York State. So he's just decided this is his thing. And I think this is an important thing to do, to talk to the state assembly and the state senate, because I think there are rumblings, and I think it's your party in the Senate that seems to be most, a little bit of news I've heard, is resisting this idea. And in fact, Dean Skelos told me a couple of years ago, I sat at a meeting with him, he said, you know, you have to remember that the Republicans in the Senate proposed a tax cap, but it was only for schools and it would have been 4%. It was Cuomo as a candidate who upped the ante and said, oh, no, we're going to cap everybody at 2%. So, you know.
I plan to vote for it. I just thought that maybe a tickle was better than a slap. I don't think
it's too late for him. This has to say what we need to say clearly to the legislature.
Okay.
Let's see if we can move on. Brian?
Thanks. Just real quickly, I don't know. It just seems like we're beginning to go down the path of delving into some minutia in this, where what we really want is a concept change, you know, a total shift. The minutia will come, hopefully, from the legislature. It will come from Albany. For example, if our budget goes down $11 million, they probably will have something in there which factors that in, and there's still a cap. To put all this stuff in there, first off, I can't see Governor Cuomo reading this or going along with it, because then he would have to admit he was wrong, that his policies are wrong. And in an election year and stuff, yeah, I mean, that just can't happen. So I think it is important that we get something. Doesn't have to be perfect. I think the meetings with assembly people and the Senate, they get it. They understand what it is we're going through. And for us to sit here and wordsmith and try to get down into the minutia on things, where what we're really asking for is just a, you know, basically a shift in the way we do taxes. They will get that no matter what's in here.
Jim, Peter, Mike.
Thank you, Michael.
Dave.
I believe the governor's plan is a wonderful, and I heard this someplace, a bumper sticker promise that as he runs and moves forward. All of you who went to NYSAC talked with people, and they listened to what you all said who were there. And it shows up on the NYSAC website from county after county who are now talking about the things that are in this resolution and what was taken up there. I think the governor has positioned all of us lowly local government officials in the perfect place. That's where he wants us. He wants us to have to face the taxpayers and say no to this bumper sticker plan that he has. And I think we've heard from Republicans and Democrats alike, please support, please follow along and send what you are thinking, because we would like to get behind those kinds of things and try to change his mind. That's why this resolution is here. I don't think we should, do commas and question marks. No disrespect to anyone, but I think it tells a good story. And whether he listens or not, the important people who need to listen are the legislators, as people have said. So I would hope we would all vote in the affirmative to quote Carol Chalk.
Peter?
I'd like to move an amendment.
Go ahead.
And the amendment would say the following. It would go in just before the last resolved, between the second last resolved and the last resolved. And the amendment is the following. Resolved, comma, further, comma, that the tax cap basis on counties would be adjusted to take into account the reduction due to the mandate takeover.
It's been moved. Is there a second for the amendment?
What? You understand what I'm saying? Is that?
I'm looking for a second, Peter.
What?
I'm looking for a second.
Oh, okay.
I'll second it for discussion.
Okay.
Can you repeat it?
Yeah. Resolve further that the tax cap basis on counties would be adjusted to take into account the reduction due to the mandate takeover. So that what I'm trying to say is that all counties would be in the same position as the other governments, like school committee and towns and cities, that they would have a tax cap on them, but that tax cap would be on what their budget was without the thing that they're taking away, that the state will now be paying.
Okay, on the amendment, I have Brian, I have Martha, I have Jim, and I have Dooley.
Me.
Brian?
No, I just had to clarify it, but we're the only one that I know of government entities, that being counties, that actually pay this. Schools don't pay it. Town, city, or, that. We pay it. So it sounds like from your amendment that you basically want to, I'm torn between do the states work for them or voluntarily handcuff yourself. You're imposing a tax limit on yourself.
Yeah. Just like all the other governments. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Martha? On the amendment.
Yeah, I appreciate the sentiment, Peter, and it's, I might consider it. However, I guess it, at core, accepts the legitimacy of the tax cap, which I don't. I mean, the tax cap is such a fundamentally offensive idea from the point of view that the state is going to tell local governments what to do. The state that can't even control its own expenditures, they're going to tell local governments what to do. I guess that's my reaction. And as Brian said, this is not the legislation. We're not proposing a legislation that's going to implement a realignment of the state payment of programs. This is a policy position, and obviously, if somebody says, "Well, I can't," I'd be for that as long as there was something in there about the tax cap. Sure. Then, if we get to that point, yeah, I guess I can't support it, unfortunately.
Jim and Dooley, and then let's vote on the amendment.
Carol, I will pass.
Jim passes. Dooley, on the amendment?
Yes, it's accepting the legitimacy of the tax cap. That was my comment, too, and Martha just said it. I oppose it.
Carol?
Yeah, I agree also, and I think Governor Cuomo is nothing if not an incredible strategist. So I think he's fully capable of coming back to all of us and saying, there's nothing in here that says that, and that's the time to bring that up. I have a question for Jim, though. I didn't quite catch whether you were looking for my wording to be added or you were saying you didn't want to do
I was
with
agreeing
it.
With what you said.
You were what? All.
No, I am not looking for any words to be added by anyone.
You were agreeing with
I would like to vote for certain things after.
You're not recognized yet.
Well, I don't need to call the question.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, we ask people to wait their turn to call a question. Dooley?
Well, I was the first one you called on. I raised one word. I had a second point, but you immediately went to someone else. So I never got to raise what I thought was important, and I also have...
Is that to do with the amendment, or did I have you on the list for on the main motion?
I'm very afraid it's going to get called before I get to speak, and that's why I mentioned that now. But I got cut off with the first question, and I hope
amendment's
going to get back to me. I have your wording, Carol, to offer. Right.
Mike?
I'd call the question.
Oh, God.
This is on the amendment.
Well, I'd like everybody to vote on it. So.
Okay. Is there a second for calling the question on the amendment? Brian. All those in favor of calling the question on the amendment, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. All right. On the Peter Stein's amendment, Kathy, can you read it for us again?
Adding the resolve further that the tax cap basis on counties would be adjusted to take into account the reduction due to the mandate takeover.
Okay, those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That fails 13-1. 1-13, I guess. Back on the main motion, I have Mike Sigler, Dave McKenna, and Dooley.
I pass. Thank you, Michael.
Dave?
Okay, my question is, what are you willing to give up? Because that's really what you're saying, okay? If the governor pays the $10 or $11.8 million, what program don't you want? There's tax cap. You can't make any more money. They don't print money at the state level. Where are you going to get the money from? What are you going to do with what's left? That's really the question, okay? What program are you willing to give up to get them to pay for the Medicare?
Dooley?
I want to offer two things. One is what I think the wording that Carol was searching for would read. This is an amendment I'm proposing. Whereas a simple principle of governance is that whatever level of government decides what is required should be the level of government that pays for the requirement. It's not what Joe had said, but it's a version of that. And I'm offering that to go on page one above the last whereas on that page.
Dooley, is your second point going to be an amendment as well?
It's going to be a question.
Okay. So then we should proceed with to act on the amendment then.
Yes.
All right. Dooley's made a proposed amendment. Is there a second? Seconded by Carol. Discussion on Dooley's amendment. Dooley?
I was trying to capture what Carol referred to that Joe had said in his original presentation to us all. And I didn't have his wording, but I tried to come up with something that said the same thing. Should I read it again?
Please.
Whereas a simple principle of governance is that whatever level of government decides what is required should be the level of government that pays for the requirement.
Carol?
Yeah, can I offer a friendly change to that? Should be the level of government. It was something about setting the taxes. The last clause of your sentence, just read that one more time. Setting the taxes to pay for would be... there shouldn't be taxation without representation. That's our basic principle of government on which we were founded. And that's the principle here, is that they're asking us to pay things that we're not getting to.
Sure, that's fine.
All right. On the amendment, anything else? Should we vote on the amendment? All of those in favor of the amendment, well, let's have it read just so we're sure everybody knows what we're talking about. Dooley is offering the following amendment. Do you have it, Kathy?
I think so.
You want me to read it?
Why don't you read it again?
Whereas a simple principle of governance is that whatever level of government decides what is required should be the level of government that collects taxes to pay for the requirement. Is that what you wanted?
Yeah. Is that... Can I ask Joe if that's acceptable to him?
Well, it's got to be acceptable to the group. All right. All those in favor of that amendment, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4. All those opposed? Should be 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Leslin left.
Leslin is gone.
No, Leslin's gone. Okay. It fails. Dooley, you had a second point? A question, you said?
Yes. As I was reading this resolution over, I looked at the second whereas, and I'm having great trouble understanding what it says, especially the second line of it.
The second whereas?
The second whereas. In year one, a state finance rebate for any increase in property taxes in municipalities that stay within the state imposed property tax cap in year two and requires. There's something missing there.
Joe?
Yeah, Dooley's right. This got jumbled up in the drafting. And I've tried to bring it back to a more coherent place. So if you would like, I can read.
Except that you're talking about the governor's proposal. I don't think it's possible.
But go ahead, Joe. Tell us where...
Okay. This is in that whereas that is the second whereas. And it probably should read, whereas the governor has proposed a two-year property tax freeze that includes a state-financed rebate for any increase in property taxes in municipalities that stay within the state-imposed property tax cap over the next 2 years, comma, while also implementing major shared services or consolidation of functions with other local governments in the second year.
Are those changes friendly to the mover and seconder?
Yes.
Okay. Then with those changes, are we ready to vote? I'm sorry, Martha had her hand up as well.
Yeah, I want to address Dave's concern. I think the point is that the state has the broad-based income tax, as well as the sales tax, to make, to use for whatever its programs are, and they have been using the property tax that we are forced to levy to pay for their programs. It's just the idea here is simply that, consistent with this change that Dooley suggested, that if you create the program, you should pay for the program. So, what are we willing to do with that? I think the point is if we are not required to pay for Medicaid anymore, then the revenue that we have exists to pay for the other things that we are in our budget, except for Medicaid and pre-K and the rest. So I don't see it as a...
It's good for us, Martha. That's fine for us. But on a state level, there's $11.8 million less money to spend, regardless of how much money you have. Okay? Because now they're paying for that program.
It could raise the income.
So whatever that was being used for, it's not going to happen. So the best way, if you want that to happen, is tell them what you don't want it to be used for.
Okay. Are we ready to vote on the main motion as with the two friendly amendments? All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
All those opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you very much. Thanks. Public Safety Committee, Brian Robinson, Chair.
Thanks, Mike. We have not met since our last LEDGE meeting. Although in between was, and I thank you, everyone, for passing the dispatch center position, which was kind of in between at that time. Let me start at the end instead of the beginning. The day after our last ledge meeting, we had a CJATI meeting, and that entire meeting was devoted, almost the entire meeting was devoted to the CJATI task force and all of the members, the staff members that are going to be on that task force were at the meeting. The ones that weren't were the members of the public, and that is, they had all the applications in. They hadn't reviewed them or whatever. I believe they've made a decision on the recommendations that they would like to have on that task force. And tomorrow, Leslin and I will be meeting with the chairs to try to solidify that. Having said that, that committee wanted a chance to get together as a unit and report back to us some of what they want to look at and to introduce the members of the public that are going to be on the committee. Susie Cook didn't feel that, in discussions with her and I, didn't feel that the next regularly scheduled public safety meeting, which is next Monday, wouldn't allow enough time for them to be able to do that. So through some other jockeying, we've finally come together today to set the next public safety committee meeting for 3:30 on the 18th, which is before the next legislative meeting. At that meeting, they are going to bring the two or three, I don't even know how many they have, folks from the public that are going to be on the task force here to the committee meeting to introduce them. Also at the committee, we are going to be the first to look at the two bonding resolutions, the one for the jail renovation project and for day reporting. It's my understanding that the scopes of those two projects are going to, and what I mean by scope is not only cost estimates but also the drawings, are going to be finalized here very quickly and should be available by the end of Friday this week and should be posted on the county's website. That will give folks roughly 10 days to look at those, see if there are any questions. If there are, I'm sure that Arel Amaro will be available to answer some questions. So, because I know a lot of folks from the public had questions on that type of scope. So hopefully a lot of those will be answered. As far as process for the meeting, there's a lot. I mean, let's face it. It's going to be another passionate night here in the chambers.
Where do you buy tickets?
and that may also be true for the committee meeting. I probably will allow a limited public comment at the meeting, but we've also got to have the introduction of the two projects, and my understanding is somebody from LaBella is going to be here and pretty much review what's already on the what's going to be already be on the website. And answer any questions, and we need to get through those two resolutions prior to budget, which is the next week. There won't be voting on those that night. what else? I guess that's
questions
it. I guess that's it.
Martha, then Will.
Thanks for moving the meeting around again. So that,
again? Yeah.
um, Are you saying that on the 18th at the legislature meeting we'll have the presentation for the, like, for everybody and for the public?
I don't know. What do you think?
We're still kind of thinking this through.
Yeah.
I don't know. At a minimum, it'll be presented to public safety. It'll be presented again at budget the following week, and then it will come back. The vote won't be until the 1st of April at your meeting. If the legislature wanted an abbreviated version of the presentation to look at the plans for both the projects, if you wanted it that day on the 18th, we can talk to LaBella.
We've already got two presentations on that day. I just want to forewarn you about that. So
on the 18th?
On the 18th. We're doing TC3, and we're doing the compliance training certifications.
Okay.
Let's talk about how we can arrange things.
Okay. All right. But that's an important piece, because I know a lot of folks had concerns about that, and they need to be able to get that information. So yes. So the meeting will be at 3:30 on the 18th, or right here. And if we could make the proper notifications, because people look at that. So, please.
Will?
Just so I'm clear, this is the Public Safety Committee meeting, where we'll be on the 18th before the legislature meeting at the same
yes.
night. Okay,
yes.
Okay, thank you. So I went up and visited the jail with Dan and Dooley, and just to see the space, and came to the realization that essentially what we are doing is taking away half of the existing program space in the jail, on the interior program space. And what we've been told is, well, yeah, but they're creating all this covered exterior space. And the question I came away with was that I was not convinced that room that we want to put beds in is completely not wanted. They have a ping pong table and a pool table, and while we were there, some folks were very actively and happily using it on a very, very cold day when they couldn't have gone outside. I guess my question is there any way to create new interior space to at least have those functions for days when it can't go outside, or are we just literally saying we will never have that as an option once this is built?
That's included in phase three, right?
Well, if you were ever to get to that point, and we're not talking about that.
Right, right.
you would vacate the jail. So the
dipping
sheriff,
your toes into something that
the road patrol and civil would vacate the jail, which would free up the entire building for use both as bed space and program space.
Yeah, I'm not going there. I'm talking short term.
So short term. Well, I mean, the plan that's been formulated, I'm afraid, is the plan that we have to decide on. So there is some sacrifice of interior space. After your visit, I checked with the sheriff and the undersheriff to make sure that when we characterized this as underused and little used, that space, that it was absolutely accurate, that we weren't misrepresenting that. So both said, and again, I haven't talked to the individuals who were incarcerated there, but both agreed that those were accurate descriptions of the use of that room. It's little used or underused.
Well, then the question is, why are they little used? Is it that they are not wanted or valued by the people who are there, or that they are not permitted access? All I can tell you is what I saw is that they were some very, very happy folks to be outside of their dorm for an hour, actively doing something physical, which they could not do inside their dorms on that day. And I guess I would implore us to say, if we're going to do this, we have to recognize that we are really cutting in something that's already in short supply, which is program space, in that facility. Is there a way at this stage to carve out some of those functions elsewhere? There is a program room that's a multi-use room. Maybe a ping pong table could go in there. I don't know. And I'm a little dubious to take a complete face value that the space is not wanted. I don't know the basis on which somebody is even permitted to go there, but.
And I get out of my element very quickly when I talk about the operation of the jail. I think those are questions for the sheriff. and the undersheriff at the committee meetings that are coming up.
Okay. Peter, I think, had his hand up.
I just wanted to say, when this whole thing started, that question was certainly raised. I raised it, and I was assured that that room is very little used. I mean, the word I remember, although it's probably not accurate, is never. But that certainly was the spirit in which it was offered.
We were all told that, but when we went up, we saw otherwise.
That's well, then it's a legitimate question.
Okay. Anything else, Brian?
No, I think that's enough.
Carol?
Well, I just had a question. If it's going to turn out that Labella isn't going to give the presentation to all of us, is it possible to have that meeting videotaped? Or at least that portion of it?
We can look into that. It may have to be at a different time than the legislature meeting, regular legislature meeting. We'll have to figure that out.
Well, I mean, it's the public safety meeting then that... You know, if Labella is going to come and give it there, whether we could, those of us who can't make it, I think, in this room.
Yeah. I think they're giving it there. I think they're giving it at budget. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
But, yeah, we can ask Jim. I mean, it's a regularly, he's going to be here that day anyway. So.
Is that online?
Right, okay. I guess we got to prolong here. Martha, then Jim.
Well, we didn't talk about having the presentation on April 1st. Can we do that? Are there other presentations on April 1st? Okay, I mean, the idea of having it on March 18th was so that people would get the information ahead of time, they'll have a chance to think about it. With two other presentations, that can't work. But I think the full legislature should get the full presentation on April 1st, and... You know, we've done that many times where you get the presentation the same day you vote on it. So Carol, it's not a matter of videotaping the committee meeting. Everybody will get the same information. And it's probably useful to do it this way because if public safety makes comments that might adjust something and then budget has a presentation, then it's a little bit iterative so that there really is a process and that what finally comes to the legislature has been through two committees for comment and revision.
All right, was there one other hand? I hope not. All right. Brian, thank you very much.
Yep.
Let's move to minutes of previous meeting, February 18. Someone want to move minutes? Mike Sigler, seconded by Martha Robertson. Discussion? Jim?
It's not about the minutes. It's something Nate said to me earlier. The documents that the woman who was up in front of the room at the beginning of the meeting, public, there are social security numbers that are in those documents. So
we should be very careful.
With that as you want. But.
Great.
Okay, so...
That was Nate's comment, by the way.
So on the minutes, all those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? There's one opposed. Any unfinished business? Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
By Brian, seconded by Mike. All those in favor of adjourning? That's unanimous. Thank you. Thank you, Kathy. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Jim.